Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's June 28th, 2020, and welcome to episode 216 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and staying out of domestic fights. I am Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I am joined by three other retro computing enthusiasts. From Portland, we have Earl Evans. How are you?
Hi, Paul. I'm doing good. Things are good here. We've had some reasonably good weather over the past few days, and you know, we're all still hunkered down, but things are moving along.
Excellent. And from Toronto, we have Carrington Manston. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Check that square on your bingo.
Okay, fantastic. And from Northern Virginia, Blake Patterson. How are you?
I'm well. It's nice and sunny and rather hot here today. And I actually got back from, we did a week away at a safe distancing private beach house where we were surrounded by people on the beach about every 100 yards. So I think it worked out in a safe and relaxing way. But we went ahead and did that, and now we're back, and glad to be on the show.
Excellent. Did you bring your 2C?
I did not bring a 2C. I brought a little bit of retro gear, handheld, but that was about it. No, okay. Beach 2C. No beach 2C.
Yeah. The host's topic today was something that actually Blake suggested years ago, I think, has been sitting in the our show notes document for a long time. But it's essentially the question of the kind of like hobby home life balance that you know one might have, you know, like how do you pursue the hobby that you want to pursue in the way that you want to pursue it while at the same time, you know, maintaining cordial relations with all that share that space. I almost feel like I don't have much to say about that myself, because the way I do that is I just put it in a different space altogether.
Well, that's one valid way to go, though.
One approach, I guess. Yeah. But anyway, maybe we can go around and talk about that a little bit and see what comes up. I don't know to what extent we've planned things to say about this. But so, Earl, since you're first in my little the window that I'm looking at, how does your family like your Altairs?
Well, here's the thing. It's an interesting topic for today, because if there's a line and the doghouse is on the other side of that line, I have walked right up to that line at this point. My toes are nuzzled right against the line. Went on a donation run yesterday, which I'll talk about a little later in the show. And now I have filled every available cubic inch that I have at my disposal. So in the past, the way that I've tried to deal with this is to have an area of the house that is dedicated to storage of hobby type stuff and to keep things within that area. That got a little more complicated when the current coronavirus issue hit and my daughter came home from dormitory and I had to clear out what we call the gadget room, which was my space where I had a lot of my stuff.
And that must have been hard.
That was pretty difficult, but it was also pretty useful because it gave me an opportunity to restructure where things are and go through some mental calculations on what I want to keep and what I want to part with. It's a little more complicated parting with things right now, again, because of the situation that we're in. But
actually, I was going to ask, when you say clear out, did you mean get rid of everything or just put it in different places?
No, I meant actually getting rid of some stuff, parting with some stuff, either through sales or donations or whatever. I have some things I want to keep, some things that are kind of on the bubble, haven't decided yet, and some things that I definitely want to go. And so I'm looking at that, but, you know, then after a donation run yesterday, now I've kind of filled up again. So, yeah, I don't know exactly how you balance it. I'll let you know in about 2 months whether or not I have successfully done that. In the past,
or if you're podcasting from a different home.
Exactly.
That's right.
In the past, though, I've tried to do it by having designated spaces, and whatever I have has to fit in that space. Not always successful, but I try.
Do the other people in your household have equivalent hobbies? Is it like you get so much space because other people are getting equivalent space? Somebody else is collecting spoons or something? Or are you the only collector in the house?
I think I'm the only collector of artifacts like this of any kind. So my junk definitely takes up more space than anybody in the house. My son has some hobbies, but the sort of things that he collects are much smaller. And so they don't take up as much room. And my daughter's hobbies tend to be more doing things, like creating some things. The stuff that she does is also very self-contained as well. I'm the offender in my house.
That's loaded language, but okay.
Yeah. Space offender.
I think I played that.
I can see that working either way. Like, you know, either you have equivalent space needs and so you sort of split the space, or only one person in the house needs the space and so it's okay.
Right. Well, in a perfect world, both people are sharing the hobby. You got two people who are cosplayers or whatever, and they have a shared collection. Then there's probably less argument about it.
That's true. So Carrington, how about you? Where do you
I have no
thing. How do you store all that vast amount of stuff?
My vast stuff is all stored behind. Actually, I still have my two rubber band bins full of software boxes that I do want to actually get rid of. Mm-hmm. But because they're in a storage unit, I never see the storage locker downstairs in the condo. I never really see them. So it seems like it's out of sight, out of mind thing, which also tells me I should get rid of them. But in anticipation of this, I had a long discussion with, and get rid of your bingo cards, folks. My girlfriend lives in Canada, totally real. Check it off. So I was talking to her because I'm a minimalist. She is whatever the best word for opposite of that is not a mean word, but like we are very different that way. So her house has a lot of things in it. So I had a discussion with her about it. I said, like, I am not a collector, but we're about to have a discussion on RCR. She's also not 100% convinced you guys are real. So, you know.
Yeah.
and so I was asking her, like, what are her thoughts on it? And she thought it was kind of silly to have massive collections, like rooms full of computer gadgets. So I said, well, you have a kitchen full of stuff. Like every drawer has kitchen things everywhere. You've got cupboards full of plates. You've got bowls. You've got mixers. You've got like crazy number of things. She thinks that is fundamentally different. But I said there is definitely 100 things in your kitchen that are used less frequently than some of my friends use their Apple II. Once a year, you use your special ladle for a certain thing. Why is that not a collection? But my friend Earl's, you know, 7,000 Altairs or whatever you just picked up are like fundamentally different. She also loves books. So she has shelves full of books because she's a reader. And a lot of people like have collections, and those are then reflections of who you are. You see yourself as a reader, so you want to be surrounded by books. Having just a Kindle is not enough for most people. They want to see all the books. But I said, but you have walls and walls of books, most of which you love, but how frequently do you read every one of those? Some might be years between even touching them. Whereas my friend Blake, you might turn around and say, well, there's a computer he only uses 5 times a year. That's 5 times more frequently than you read that book. How is that collection fundamentally different than his collection? She argues it is absolutely different, and it is ridiculous to have a bunch of retro computers. So she was not open to that argument at all. Uh-huh. But it got me thinking about, like, why is one thing a like collection and another thing is just a bunch of furniture in the guest room? Why are those different? So I don't know. But to me, it seems that we're drawing arbitrary lines about what is a collection that clutters up your house and what is just a room only the guests that get to stay in. And I don't know that they're actually fundamentally different. So says the minimalist.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. The question of use too is also, you know, figured into that, because it does seem like a collection of retro computers might be a set of things that you use, you know, mm-hmm. As opposed to whatever, you know, anime figures or something.
Well, yeah, her grandmother collects salt and pepper shakers. Yeah. So there's all these little shelves up high with all these cute little salt and pepper shakers from all the places she's traveled. And so we talked about that. Like, she's got 300, 5,000, whatever, salt and pepper shakers. You need one salt and pepper shaker that's used. And then these are just decorative. So they're not mm-hmm. even meant to be used. They're now just like art. So I said, well, what if I love the aesthetics of the, which I do. I adore the industrial design. Like, I would have an Atari 800. I could just look at that. Like, to me, that brings an aesthetic pleasure equal to or greater than I get from if I hung a bunch of art up. I just want to look at an Atari 800, even though I can't turn it on. It just brings me joy looking at it. So couldn't a part of the element of a computer collection be that? Like, it's an aesthetic thing. It's an art collection, just like a museum would have. So it's not even, like, even if you don't touch it, like, what's the difference between that and salt and pepper shakers? Her argument was salt and pepper shakers, if you have 500 of them, that's still just like two small shelves in the living room, whereas 500 retro computers is, you know, you need another floor. So that's also an element. But we ended up having like a very long discussion about this. And I came away thinking, there's no difference between having five things and having like a spare guest room. I think everyone should have the biggest collections they want.
And in other news, you are newly single.
No, but she made that joke a few times.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, but I'm not in that position. Like, we don't have shared cohabitation. It's just me in my empty, echoing, you know, Johnny Ive space. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is a thing we're going to have to deal with. But at the moment, it's just like she can have tons of stuff. I can have tons of nothing. And then we're fine. And every second weekend, she lives here and talks about Echoes. And every other weekend, I'm there like, we got to clean your books. So that's how we deal with it.
Excellent. Well, you could sort of sneak one away every once in a while and just see how long it takes before, like, when it's down to 12.
But see, that could be, I mean, you shouldn't do that. That would be a terrible thing to do in a relationship.
Of course.
I bet you if I went and grabbed 20 random books, she might never notice, but she wouldn't notice soon. Whereas if I went and snuck into Blake's place and took a computer, how quickly would you would notice right away? You walk in the room and go, hey, what? Where's my...
Yeah.
So that could also be a thing. Like,
I would notice immediately.
Don't you think, or would you not notice?
I would notice because I actually, when I come in the room, like, as part of the aesthetic thing, like, I always kind of glance around the room, like, here it is, you know, because it's taken up this huge space in my house. And I'll get into that in a minute. But yeah, I would notice. yeah, in a way, you'd be a blessing because, like, what I don't have is one computer workstation worth of free empty desk to do like repairs on, you know, which is why I do repairs on the floor, you know. So it would actually be a good thing if you took one and stole it away. Then I just would be sure not to replace it. But yeah.
So the only suggestion she had was, if you're going to have a large collection for things, it is not unreasonable for other people in the household and for you to have a discussion for where the space will be for that collection. And then that is set out as a relatively firm guideline, like this room or these walls or this much space or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then that's it. So if you get to the point where you fill that, you have to get rid of something before you put another thing in. It doesn't just get to spill into the hallway. So, and that seemed like a pretty reasonable limitation to put on any sort of collection, retro computers or otherwise.
I think that's true.
Yeah. I wonder if it was, Blake, you were talking about, like, you know, not having a space to put, you know, repairs on. I wonder if a good thing to have in such a room would be like a workbench table or whatever that like folds down from the wall. So like it's always free because you can't leave anything on it.
That presumes an empty wall though.
Yeah, it does. There's no empty wall.
Have it come down from the ceiling maybe.
Ah, cool. Yeah, actually, like one of those beds that just drops down.
There's an idea. But I always get envious. I see, like, you know, on YouTube, you know, whatever, some of the different channels, they'll have someone will have a proper workspace. You know, he's got, because I mean, I've got the soldering kit. I've got all the parts stuffed up on shelves and I bring it all together and do it somewhere. Sometimes I do it on the dining room table and that gets into that zone where there are those in the house that are very much not appreciating that temporary usage out of this room. Anyway, but, you know, they'll even have, like, on these, someone will have a workstation that has, like, the metal painted grid of measurements. You know, it's like 1 inch or 1 centimeter per square so that you can actually, when you're explaining something on a video, people can see exactly what size it is or, you know, or, like, you can use that alone, you know, for your own benefit. And, I kind of wish that I had something like that, but I don't. But, anyway.
Yeah, it's actually really psychologically difficult and maybe physically difficult when like the space is just crammed full of things like that, because then you can't use any of them. Because, you know, everything needs to have stuff plugged into it, or, you know, you have to open it up to do some sort of thing. And
yeah, so definitely.
I'm pretty sure in my space I've kind of hit that point where everything is third thing down in a pile. So anyway, maybe Blake, we can turn to you and your basement space or whatever that is.
My topic from however many years ago, I guess I can't remember. It was long before I was part of the show, certainly. But yeah, I'll say at the beginning, I'm still married. So despite this hobby, and I've been married about almost 22 years, and for almost 20 of those years, I've been collecting since about 2000. So,
so you started collecting after you were married?
I did.
Okay, so that's interesting. A lot of times you can't.
No.
Bring a big thing to, like, you can start a relationship with a motorcycle, but you can't add a motorcycle to a relationship. So I would have thought you can't add giant retro computing hobby to a marriage. So that's actually pretty encouraging.
You can. Yeah, I did the same thing.
Okay.
It's possible.
My goodness. My mind.
But yeah, so I guess I started out, we lived in a small, it was small, a small townhouse, when we were first married. And yeah, there was an upstairs room that was sort of an office, you know, just one big room. And so that was where I put the main computer, just the Mac, you know, like it wasn't collecting. And then we moved in there in 98, I guess, but then it was around 99, 2000, somewhere right in the cusp there. I got an idea. I think we talked about this before. I won't go into great detail, but I think it was an Apple IIgs that I saw on eBay, and I thought it'd be nice to have, you know, to have one of those again. And then, you know, I think it was like an Amiga CD32. And then I thought, well, I could just get a full Amiga. I have room if I put another desk up here. So anyway, so we lived in the house for like 4 years, and then we moved, and we came to this location like just a couple miles away. And there was a big unfinished, like sizable room. I think it's like 18 by 12 or 14 or something like that. And we had it finished cheaply. It's actually, the ceiling is about 1 inch taller than me, so technically we couldn't have it finished by code, but we did. Anyway, so this is the place where I guess I went from like four or five computers with the extra space, and I added more. But it's always been down in this room where I'm sitting now. And I guess I try to, as long as everyone in the family, which is my wife and my 14-year-old daughter, seem to be on very much urging and insisting that the things remain in this room. and given that that's the case, they don't seem to mind if I also am in this room for some spans of time. But I think, you know, with repair stuff, sometimes I'll take a few things up to the dining room table. Or the kitchen counter. But that's sort of, you know, I get the eyebrow, and like, if it's there for more than a day, you know, I'm definitely feeling the need to bring that back. So I typically, sadly, just, you know, work on the floor when I'm just like soldering a new battery in or trying to repair a broken ribbon cable or something like that. It would be nice to remove one of the computers and have a workspace, even if it's, you know, small. I guess for, in order to enjoy some of the hobby, you know, out of this room, you know, like I use some of the, that's a way to utilize some of the retro mobile machines, like, you know, the HP 100LX or like one of the, like the E-mate or something. Like I can fiddle around on the couch, like on a BBS or something. Cause again, BBSing is a big thing for me these days. Easy enough. So you're using the system, and usually when you're on the BBS, you're topic is the hobby, so it's double feeding there, as we talked about in that past episode some time back. But I guess I've taken some other routes, another way to spend some time, let me go ahead and share my screen if I can. I'm going to share a window. If I move over here, this is, I guess I have a pen. This is just the space, so you can see the kind of the clutter of what I'm talking about. This is a few years old, this picture, for those watching on YouTube. But it's, you know, this is basically what I've got around the room. As you can see, yeah, there's no wall space to have a retractable workspace in there. Mm-hmm.
So are we going to have a link to this in the show notes? Because I hadn't seen this before. This is like a little 3D panorama with everything labeled. So for listeners at home, this is really cool. And I think people would like to see this.
Surely, yeah. Surely. Actually, what I did was it was a QuickTime. I took a QuickTime VR of the.
I remember those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And it sort of gives you a nice surround. There is actually, I don't think the browsers will play it anymore, but the QuickTime VR, yeah, I'm trying it, and it says unsupported plugin. There's a QuickTime VR file where you can actually rotate your horribly fish-eyed. Do you remember QuickTime VR, people?
Sure.
Okay. I did, yeah.
Yeah, so I used the studio to create the thing. Anyway, sure, I'll put a link to the show notes, but that's basically...
So this image of your retro computers is best viewed on a retro computer.
Yes, in fact. If you want to see the original QuickTime VR, definitely. So yeah, so that's a space. But then, like, I ran out of space. I don't add anything else because there's no more space. But, and this is the original. I told you how it started out in the small room up in the other house. And here we have, like, a much more modest... Well, a normal person wouldn't call this modest. And my wife would not call this modest. But at any rate...
Is that a Lethal Weapon poster in the background?
Yes, my wife was a huge Lethal Weapon fan back in college. So
That's her very poster. Circa appropriate.
Her poster, yeah, I have a Princess Bride poster a few inches to the left.
Awesome.
Interesting combination. But yeah, so I've taken some, I've gotten, you know, mixed reactions from attempts to maybe a little bit far afield attempts to kind of bring some of the retro computing into other spaces. And one of those would be when I had the bedside Apple IIc, which is both practical, you know, when someone's reading and, you know, watching a movie on an iPad, like you've got a internet connected BBS or Telnet machine. But again, it's a little strange to have the bedside Apple IIc. I mean, the beach Apple IIc is one thing.
That's totally
bedside
normal.
Bedside is another. This is a short-lived enterprise, I have to say. I'll go ahead and tell you that. So looking for another place for it, I actually moved it to my office. So I have – this is where – original location, I had the 2C in an office. My current space, you know, I have a cubicle now, and you know, so this is actually connected to the internet. So, like, you know, at lunch or something, a few times a week, I'll – fire it up and, you know, have it, you know, logged into an IRC channel or something like that. So I get, you know, I get to use it. But as far as what Carrington was saying, I mean, really the aesthetic is another thing. It's nice seeing it sitting on the desk during the day. So it's like I'm spending time with the vintage setup, but it's not taking time from the family sort of thing. You know, it's like trying to get little pieces of it while other things are happening. And it gets, you know, obviously lots of comments when people walk by. A lot of people come in and say, this is the first computer that was ever made. And I was like, well, not exactly. it is an old one. It is an old one. You know, so yeah, so it's in the cubicle there. Basically, definitely am conscientious of splitting time between, you know, family events, of course, like the evenings, you know, we'll watch movie, TV, that kind of thing. But then it sort of ranges off into, you know, some of my daughter's particular, you know, interests that, you know, my wife is, you know, she'll, you know, sit around, do her thing, and I'll maybe pop in here for a little bit in the evening. So it's, you know, it works out, I guess, as far as the balance. And I guess the it boils down to, again, making the balance work is certainly about keeping everything in this room. As my wife, you know, has pointed out, it's not a small room, and it's the entire room. And my daughter was afraid to walk in here until she was about 9 years old. She thought she was going to be electrocuted. Again, I guess the end result is, you know, I'm 22 years, still married, so it must be fairly well working.
Well, you brought up an interesting point, not just balancing space, but balancing time. So,
yeah.
You know, it's an important thing to think about. I tend to be pretty conversational, and so... with my family, you know, I think, you know, occasionally they'll look at me and, don't you have some retro computers to go play with or something like that? So, and, uh-huh. You know, I don't tend to get heads down multiple hours for multiple days in a row on projects. Mm-hmm. It's like I just kind of hit a project for an hour or two and then walk away and then come back to it another time. So it really doesn't get in the way from a time perspective. Never had that problem.
Yeah, I think it's like I find myself, you know, it feels a little strange. I'm thinking what was, you know, that was certainly was a short session, but I'll come in and, you know, turn on like the Apple IIe or the Amiga and do like 10 minutes on a bulletin board or something, or check out something, and then switch it off. And then, you know, I'm back doing something else. And mm-hmm. it's just a little teeny tidbits, because the time is certainly a factor. And of course, with my wife and I have our particular areas, but we're certainly nightly doing like homework, you know, kind of assistance with my daughter. And they have an unbelievable amount of homework. She's, you know, Alexandria Public School, but it's nothing. When I think about what I had as a kid, it's insane. 10 o'clock at night. So, you know, there are time pressures aside from, you know, the whole career situation, which of course is ongoing. So, mm-hmm. but yeah, time is definitely a big thing, I think, for me.
Let's see. For me, you know, I guess I mentioned this before, but I am fortunate enough that I have an office and tenure.
Good combo.
So, yeah. So, I mean, like, ultimately, I think, you know, just people in academia are weird in all kinds of ways. And so, you know,
I think eccentric was the word you were looking for.
Yeah, perhaps.
No,
perhaps.
He was looking for weird. You found it.
But, you know, so to me, you know, I look at my office and it's just ridiculous. You know, there's just stacks of computers and things. And, you know, there are a number of things that are organized vertically. You know, so I've got the K-Pro on the bottom because it's nice and square. But nothing can be on top of the PET because the top slants.
But the PET has a lot of cavity space inside there. That's you considered nesting?
Yeah,
exactly. Like the Russian dolls of retro.
Exactly. Yeah. But, I mean, so generally I don't have anything at home. You know, that has been the case mostly. You know, it's been most of the stuff that I have been collecting has been just, you know, in my office. And I'm there doing work anyway. And, you know, when I'm not doing work, I can do a little bit of this stuff. It's gotten a little out of control, I suppose, but it's not bothering any of the people I work with because it's behind, you know, the doors and it doesn't get home. It's been a little different recently because, you know, now I'm stuck at home with all the stuff not here. So I have actually brought back an Apple III and some various, you know, stuff that goes along with that.
I was going to say by separating your hobby stuff and moving it over to work, that means when you want to enjoy your hobby stuff, you have to be at work.
Yeah.
Which is an unfortunate combination, kind of. Like a lot of times we want our hobbies to be escapes from work. Right. So when you're at home, you don't have access to your escape.
Yeah.
Except now.
It's not perfect. You know, it's nice because I have this kind of unconstrained space that I have access to, and, you know, there's fast internet and whatever, it's air conditioned. but at the same time, you know, particularly recently, it's been sort of obvious how it is not where I am. So I haven't run into that much trouble. So my wife is not, you know, does not have a similar kind of collecting bug, you know, so I don't think I could get away with having everything here. You know, it would just become obviously too much in a way that it isn't when it's hidden in my office. So, I mean, you know, it's obviously too much to me as well. Obvious to me that it is too much. I mean, but nevertheless, you know, like I want to do a little bit with each of these things before I let them go.
Sure.
So,
I mean, that's the reason. I mean, we talked about having these things for aesthetics, but a lot of times people have them because they want to use them or they want to scan them. There's a big archival desire with a lot of people in our hobby where they pick up a thing from eBay and the goal isn't just to have it or even to have it forever, but to scan it and preserve it and then maybe let it go. But then the things that are coming in much faster than the scanning, the preserving, and the letting go is happening. So it's the I Love Lucy thing with all the conveyor belts. It's that
yeah.
And you end up with a house full of pies.
So the trick there is to just live in the same city as Savitz, so that when you get your, you know, 579 VMS manuals, you can ask for some help.
Dump them on K. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Just say it's other people's problems.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's definitely been my goal with a lot of the stuff that's taking up space. I mean, I think once I've scanned a lot of stuff, I don't know what's going to happen to it actually after I'm done scanning it because there is a lot of stuff that, you know, no one really wanted anyway, right? I mean, a bunch of like edgyware and things that I want to make sure gets preserved, but then, you know, who's going to want this? You know, whatever.
Especially once it's preserved and you made it really easy to enjoy it virtually.
Yeah.
Well, now I don't need it anymore.
Right. So.
So what you have to do is before you upload anything to the Internet Archive, that's when you have to sell it on eBay where it still looks obscure. And then someone buys it and you immediately upload it. It's like, ah, sucker.
Yeah.
Now, Paul's secret plan.
Yeah, I have thought about that a little bit. Like, you know, that there are certain things that, you know, people would buy because they think they want to try to preserve it. And it would be kind of mean, actually, in a way, not to just put in the eBay auction. Like, here's the thing on the Internet Archive. If you want the physical object, you know, this is it. But don't get it just to scan it because it has been scanned.
I hadn't thought of that before.
Good point.
It's actually a good point. I think there might be a moral imperative to let people know that you've already scanned it and preserved it. Because they might, you're right, see a thing and say, oh, that's unpreserved. I should get it.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, no, it was just recently preserved by me. That's why I'm dumping it. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now there's no Kansas Fish to dump it at.
Right.
This year, but. Okay, I don't think I had much more to say about that. And time is ticking on. So I think we can move on to other segments of the show here. What is the next segment? I guess the next segment is listener feedback. It's been a long time since any listener feedback has been talked about here. So,
technically, wasn't the topic we just did technically listener feedback?
Yeah. I guess it was. Yeah.
Because Blake suggested it when you weren't on the show. That's so right. We've really been doing listener feedback from the beginning.
That's right. Okay. So,
saying, look at us.
Continuing on in the same segment then.
Uh-huh. it is kind of hard to tell the difference between our segments at the best of times, to be honest.
We need little jingles that we can put in.
Oh, yes. Earl, start singing to us.
Oh.
Yes. On the Facebook group, Ben posted something which I thought was kind of entertaining. I haven't actually read it through it completely, but it is Collapse OS. It's work being put together to basically allow for microcontrollers to be programmed into the future after the general collapse of society and manufacturing and everything
that. The global supply chain collapsing completely, and this is aimed at that.
Yeah. So, you know, what can we do to still be able to control microcontrollers in an environment where all you have are like big electronics that you can hand solder together and, you know, some Z80s.
Yeah, what do you call it? It's got to be scavenge friendly or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Switches and LEDs.
It's based on Forth, because Forth is, even apart from any questions of elegance, it's sort of compact. You can get a relatively high-level language out of relatively few bytes.
It's very good for limited platforms.
So there's a very basic looking web page that, you know, sort of goes through all of like why we think that the collapse is coming and why Forth is being chosen as the language of choice for this. And there's a project in Source Hut. First I'd heard of Source Hut, but here's the project in Source Hut, Collapse OS. It's pretty interesting, actually. I mean, you know, I don't know that I want to subscribe to the whole ideology of it, but at the same time, it's pretty interesting. Did you guys have a chance to look at this, Carrington? It seemed like you had at least skimmed over it.
Yep. Yeah, I had indeed. I found the whole thing hilarious.
Yeah.
Like it's because I like retro computers, and my favorite decade is still basically the 80s. And one of the nice things about the 80s was there was always an impending apocalypse, and there's going to be punks, and we're going to be living in a wasteland. And,
true.
You know, it was like in 15 seconds, it's going to be just wasteland everywhere. So this kind of appeals to me that, of course, we're going to have to like go through the rubble and put together our computers and have an OS. I think there's a lot of forethought put here.
Yeah.
And the whole thing appeals to me kind of from an aesthetic standpoint. I don't know how seriously you take it, but I love it.
Well, I mean, I think it's being treated seriously as far as like trying to get the platform running.
I knew all that Forth study was going to come in handy someday.
Yeah. Anyway, so take a look at that if you haven't. I intend to read through the rest of it at some point. Also on Facebook, Nelle posted something which was, it's basically a two-part YouTube video on, that's a U.S. Navy film from, I think it might be the 50s, on essentially like targeting computers and, you know, analog computing and stuff like that. And I think it's possible that we might have even discussed this on the show at some point.
That totally rings a bell for me as well. Yeah. I think somewhere in our archive we talked about this, like the whole analog computers, specifically with gun control things for the Navy.
Yeah. They're basically like instructional videos of some kind. And so it's pretty interesting to look at them. But then actually also after those were posted, Corey, who is the person who's giving this lecture, so I guess I can use the full name, Dr. Corey Millay, posted that he actually did a whole sort of like lecture on this that is on Vimeo. You can watch this if you want to kind of get a sort of discussion of the analog computation in a digital world. So that's kind of cool. I have not watched this yet, but I did note that it was interesting when I opened up the video. It said Linda Hall Library, and I thought, I know where the Linda Hall Library is. This is actually just, you know, minutes away from where Kansas Fest is generally held.
So, oh, cool.
We had several people. I actually didn't manage to track down all of the people who wrote to us about Kit driving up the back of the truck down the highway.
Oh, Lord. But, the reverse video? Okay.
Yeah. Apparently that is... It may well be true, but it didn't have to be true. Mythbusters worked out...
Really?
Yeah, they tried this out, and basically you can drive up forward into a truck.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, because my father was a NASA engineer, and watching this, he just kind of guffawed when he saw it. He's like, well, you realize what they're doing. And then he demonstrated with, like, he had the motorized. Yeah, and so we talked about it, and then I thought, oh, okay, well, that makes perfect sense. But I didn't realize that, so it is possible.
Yeah, so I guess Mythbusters actually, like, drove a car into a truck.
Okay.
You know, can we do this?
Yeah.
I'm spreading misinformation. I apologize. Yeah. It sounds like.
No, it doesn't mean they. I suspect they did it backwards
in the real show. Kids,
because why would you take the risk? Just do it backwards. Of course, you're just filming it.
I think
Mythbusters just proved it could be possible to drive in and not launch through the truck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like looking at the suspension, it looked so gentle. Like, I feel like it would, I think I was watching it saying, okay, is it leaping? You know, but I'll have to watch the Mythbusters to see what it looks like when that thing hits the ramp.
I mean, I think it has something partly to do with just like the inertia of the whole system. I mean, like, you know, you're not, it wouldn't leap forward because it's for the same reason that you don't accelerate from like 0 to 100 in a second.
So maybe the tires would peel out rather than the car being thrust up into the cab of the truck. Or maybe you film it at like 4 miles an hour and then speed up the film.
Yeah. Well, we can watch Mythbusters to see. So, I mean, they did kind of work out like there is some sort of compensating force that keeps it from, that sort of keeps it slow at the bottom of the ramp once it hits the ramp. So Brian was one of the people on Facebook who wrote about this, but I could find them, but I know that like at least three different people wrote to us about this.
Okay.
Let's see. We got a lot of people writing to us about the As Seen on TV stuff. So I will.
Because we clearly didn't spend enough time on it. We should do a second episode.
That's right. So I'll mention a couple things here anyway.
There were some really good ones people came up with though.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and Earl, I guess you recognize this one, on The Walking Dead, season 7, episode 10. And I don't watch the show, so I don't actually know this. But, well, actually, Earl, you do watch it?
I do. And I remember when Rick was confronted by Metal Zombie Dude, and he grabs a TRS-80 Model 3 out of the... that sounds like a great band name, doesn't it? Metal Zombie Dude?
Metal Zombie Dude.
So he grabs the Model 3, you know, starts chucking it at the dude. I was like, no. But, yeah, the form factor is so immediately recognizable.
Oh, yeah.
But in David's email, he also said that it's probably not a coincidence that a trash showed up in a junkyard fight.
Like, that was great. Yeah.
So well done. So well done.
Yeah. Very cool.
Yeah.
And I think Earl, you wrote back, but a point that you made, I think, was a good one, which is that this also, you know, sort of seeing the fate of that Model 3 on the television show might make you think, if you are a collector, if a television show asks to borrow your stuff.
And I've seen that written by people who have either been in the business of providing vintage computers for period pieces, you know, TV movies. A couple different places I saw it posted that, you know, just keep in mind, you might not get it back, or what you get back might not be worth having. So something to think about, because especially with an action show, I mean, you never know what's going to happen to that poor thing.
Yeah. You don't want to be like, you know, dispatching zombies with your Apple One.
Yeah. I mean, how bad could a zombie bite be comparatively?
Right, exactly.
Trash map one, get eaten by a zombie. It's a tough one. It's a tough call.
Yeah.
So let's see. Somebody else wrote, Scrap Arcade on Twitter, wrote to mention the Riptide pilot. I don't know. Riptide is one of these shows that I sort of vaguely remember existing. But anyway, we were given a YouTube link, and about 29 minutes in, there's a extended scene of, like, you know, like raiding a lab for what? See, I think it's mostly like VT-100 terminals or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Riptide. I loved Riptide. It was like, you know, detective show. Two guys. I think they might have been brothers, and then they had this sort of nerd,
like a nerdy guy,
geek
right?
friend, right? And he like he would kept punching with his thumb in his hand and breaking his thumb whenever he would try to save the guys. And he had like a little red robot that hung out. I loved the show because of the geek side guy. You'd always like you'd see his robot or his he was wiring something. Definitely, that was the draw. I remember very well. They had that pink helicopter, that crazy pink military helicopter.
With the bell fines, right?
It had like
I knew I recognized this from somewhere. I haven't thought of this show in forever.
Yeah, it had one of the best 80s theme songs too. Like it's the whole intro is just beautiful. Yeah, that's a good show.
I think I saw the robot that you speak of, and it has basically what I thought of was that it was built with like a Nerf football as its head.
It looks Nerf. It looks like a Nerf thing. Yeah, it's got that red conical face or whatever. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I wonder if it actually was.
It might have been. And I think, yeah, the main guy like was in Major Dad or something. No, that was Craig T. Nelson. I don't know. Anyway, I knew he was in The NeverEnding Story as the dad. But
All right. I always thought that the existence of The NeverEnding Story 2 was very funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. Actually, I'm going to be a nerd right here. Did you know that the NeverEnding Story, I have the book, the translation of the German original by Robert End. The first half of the book is the first movie. The second half of the book is the second movie. Believe it or not, if you actually read it. But the second half is far, far less enjoyable than the first half. But yeah, I didn't know that until I bought the book from a used bookseller overseas and read it.
So it's like Don Quixote that way. Like there's lots of things where people kind of only think of the first half of something.
Yeah, that's cool. I guess.
You're like the Old Testament.
Another good example. Excellent.
also good example.
What was I going to say? Oh, yeah. So the next person who wrote was Simulant Retro on Twitter. I don't know who these people are. Unfortunately, I only know these Twitter handles. But asking about the ZX Spectrum and other retro computers featured on Bandersnatch interactive movie on Netflix, the Black Mirror thing.
Oh, yes.
I can't believe that hadn't occurred to me. Yeah.
I never... Like, we talked about that, I think, before it hit Netflix, and then I never thought about it again. Have any of you, like, watched this or heard anything about it?
Yeah, we went through it.
Oh, sure, yeah.
We went through it. We tried different paths through the... It was fun. It was an amazing, innovative use of interactive TV, I thought. I don't know to what extent that genre would take off, but for that particular unique... adventure. It was tons of fun. The whole family enjoyed it, actually. And, you know, my kids were not in the time when we played adventure games, but my son actually really loved it.
I will have to check it out.
I missed that one. I heard a lot about it.
Let's see. Who else? Veej wrote on Twitter saying, we were talking about Triumph of the Nerds, which is a Robert X. Cringely documentary, and I guess this is a second PBS series called Nerds 201, which centers on the rise of the internet. So...
which I had not seen.
Yeah.
That one was new to me.
I had not heard of it.
I think I saw it, and it was a lot more interesting than the book, honestly. I did not enjoy the book. There was a book, Nerds 2.0.1, that was, you know, I don't know whether that came after the documentary was made or if it was before and they made it based on it, but whatever. See the movie, don't read the book. That would be my recommendation.
Interesting. Okay.
With apologies, I'll say that. It was just, the book was too much, in my opinion, naming of people and events and stuff like that. It almost felt like reading the dictionary. So, but the video was good.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out. And then Beach also mentioned that Mission Impossible and Independence Day had Apple Power, old Apple PowerBooks, and that there were several Steve Jobs films. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, they used the PowerBook to deliver that computer virus into the alien.
Yeah, Independence Day, yeah, famously using a PowerBook. That's one. Sure,
complete with the laughing face right before it triggered.
Yep, like all the best viruses.
Yeah, that's right. Wasn't it... maybe this was in 24 or something, but there definitely are. There was at least a story of being able to distinguish the good guys from the bad guys by whether they were using like Apple laptops or like PC, like Windows laptops.
Oh,
like all the bad guys were using Windows. it might have been in 24, but you know, like I think it might be. I could imagine this being a condition under which Apple would provide equipment.
Oh, right, that it can't be used for terrorism or whatever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, I can see that under the product placement rules. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I bet you that is the case.
Right.
And then I guess the last bit of this was Chuck on Facebook wrote about Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, where you can see in the background of like some shot of Captain Kirk's office, you can see he's established as a collector of antiques, and you can see kind of a modified pet there. This particular pet was auctioned off, and you can see pictures of what it looked like. It was sort of chrome plated and adjusted in a couple of ways, but it was so sort of obviously a pet.
And I mean, I love the movie. It's amazing to me that I didn't know that computer was auctioned off. Like the fact that had been auctioned was completely news to me. And I don't think we ever talked about it on the show, did we?
No, I don't think so. It looks like on the auction site, it might be saying that it was auctioned in June 2017. Though, in fact, actually, what is it now? Exactly 3 years ago, June 28th, 2017.
I really think that this flew by without me knowing about it.
Yeah.
I certainly didn't know about it.
So would you have bid?
Oh, definitely would have bought it. Yeah. Everything would have been different.
Anyway, yeah, it's kind of on the auction site, there are a couple of little screen. I guess there's one screen capture. No, there's a couple of sort of like zoomed in on the keyboard, and you can sort of see it in the distant background in a shot of the room.
And you have to have an account to view what it sold for.
Yeah.
But if you look at the details, they were expecting it to go for between $2,000 and $3,000.
Really? That's not very much.
No.
That's not very much
right?
at all.
Right? And so you'd have actually, like, come on, man. Like, for $2,300 or whatever, you could add Captain Kirk's like actual computer and play out all your Wrath of Khan fantasies.
Yeah, that's not crazy.
You know you have.
That's not crazy high.
No.
At all.
Okay, and then the last thing. So this is a note. I guess half these things are notes about things that I haven't yet investigated myself. But so Todd wrote an email to point out that Apple Fritter, the site, it's sort of a, I don't know, it's kind of like a general Apple enthusiast site. It's like a forum. But the guy who runs that site has done an eWorld reboot. And so there's, if you go visit the link here, it has, you can download a client, and then you can sort of connect to eWorld, which is I guess it's a little AOL-like, right?
Yeah, I remember eWorld. I was on eWorld.
So I got as far as actually downloading the client, but I actually didn't launch it, so I don't know what happens after that. But it's kind of neat, though.
I think it's incredibly neat, and I'm very tempted. So I guess there's clients for Echo S 10 and Windows, but then you just get the regular BBS. But if you use the classic Macintosh client that he's got out for anywhere from System 7 to 9, mm-hmm. Then you get to see it as eWorld. Like, you get the full eWorld experience. And I'm sorely tempted to check this out.
Yeah.
I think it's very cool. There is not, however, a client for William Shatner's personal pet computer.
Yes. I guess that's one downside.
Right.
Okay. I think that's it for the listener feedback. So now we can turn to the highly distinct items of interest in news, but where I don't have to do all the talking.
thank you for the listener feedback, by the way. Keep those cards and letters coming in.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's definitely interesting to see what we missed, because there's usually plenty of that.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, Blake, you have web rings.
Yes, I've got a couple of, I've got some fairly quick ones. So I was, I don't really recall exactly where I saw this, but I remember, you know, back, and many of us will remember, I think, back when the internet was new, well, you know, when we were in the public, just getting acquainted with it. I guess I'm thinking back 94, 95, you know, I had my little homepage, and there were these web rings, which were basically, I guess you'd sign up, you'd submit your link to it on a form based on some topic, and you'd get a little widget to put at the bottom of your site, and you were on the ring, and there was hit, you know, next site, previous site. So basically, if someone saw that and said, oh, this is a site of a certain sort, if I click next, I'd maybe take it to a similar site. There's a new web ring, basically. And again, it could be that these are, I don't see web rings anymore, and it could be that they're happening more frequently than I see, but this kind of just popped up. It's a fellow starting something called the Geek Ring, and it's just another web ring. And it looks like, yeah, a simple page explaining the ring that looks like it might have been created in 1995.
Right.
And basically it explains, welcome to the Geek Ring. It's a web ring for geeks of all sorts, except those who feel excluded by the use of the word geek. He provides a little information as a form. You can submit your site. He's on IRC. I actually was able to catch the guy on Freenode IRC. His online name is Dusted. So I submitted my site, the Byte Seller blog, and I see he added it to the ring. So I just went ahead and put the little widget on my blog. You can see it down at the bottom. I scroll down to the bottom, and here's the little graphic. It's actually a single graphic complete with a little pixel area map, old school. These are not buttons. They're actually mapped out, and you have the ability to choose this banner image as a GIF, a JPEG, or a PNG. And so I went with the GIF, so I get a nice dither action on the.
It is seriously dithered.
Yeah.
My goodness. I think they intentionally picked colors that wouldn't blend, like this weird green, and to make it really dither.
Even the single shade of gray on the face of these buttons is heavily dithered.
Yeah, they didn't pick a gray that would be in the web call. Like,
yeah, it's it looks like they've got about 100 or so sites, and they're certainly not all, you know, retro computing related. If I click previous, I'm taken to a code random website, which is just some person. It's like he's poetically explaining part of his day, a previous site, and here's, you know, another site from a self-proclaimed geek, I suppose. But anyway, it's sort of fun. It was a couple hours of fun times looking at it and putting it on my blog. So that was sort of cool. I thought it felt, you know, kind of retro. And actually, as a result of this, my next item of interest is something I found in, you know, choosing, give me a random site on this geek ring. Mm-hmm. And on the Stack Exchange Retro Computing, Stack Exchange Coders website has other topics too. Retro computing is one. And it's a nice delve into the Windows 95, it's now safe to turn off your computer's display, which is just orange text on a black background. In VGA graphics mode. And what it does is someone explains, I think someone asked the question, you know, why is it not safe to turn off my computer? And so various people go into history of shutting down PCs. Why did it take so long? What's the danger? Why don't we do this today? Was it that hard to implement a self shut off? Yes. Yes, it was. there was no soft power. And so I thought it was, you know, it's fun. I didn't learn a great many things personally as I was here along for the ride during this whole thing. But I imagine even if you were as well, it's worth a read. And I think a lot of people might find it pretty interesting with some info they might not have known. But anyway, so those are my two items, and they're kind of linked a little bit. So see, the web ring started paying off already for me. So shout out for that geek ring.
What's funny thing about the Geek Ring is on its site, it is itself a member of the Hotline web ring.
Yeah.
So it's part of a web ring. And then when I looked at the Geek Ring's own, check out the other awesome websites in the Geek Ring graphic, I noticed that like the next site in line wasn't site two. You think it would be site two. Because the Geek Ring site is site number six of the Geek Ring ring. I'm like, so like you weren't even the first person to join your own ring. It's kind of weird. So, and in fact, the seventh, because they started with number zero. So I don't know if it's this person put their own other site. I would have assumed that the first thing would be your own ring, but nope. So it was so good. Even they weren't the first people to join. Other people were rushing at the door. So I thought that was great.
Yep. I think looking at the list, it looks like I'm number 58.
Oh yeah. You're 58 out of 78. I see it. Right.
78. Nice. But yeah, that is, I hadn't noticed, but yes, Geek Ring is not number one.
Nope. It's number six.
Anyway.
I dig it. I dig everything about it.
Felt kind of cool. And definitely the dithered GIF feels mighty cool to have at the bottom of that site. And what I need now is a under construction, you know, animated guy,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
This site is under construction, digging, you know, so.
So a couple things that you remind me I miss about the early web days. One was web rings, because I thought they were a really effective way of finding content that you were interested in. And another was categorical search. Like, you know, I think the old Yahoo.
Oh, like Yahoo style?
Yeah, exactly. Where you could go to a category, and if you had a website, you would register for that category. So you had actual humans that were curating the categories, as opposed to the Google, where you just throw everything into the mix and then have, you know, an almost sentient AI try to dig it out for you. But it's not very effective. I just, on a whim, just here while you were talking, Blake, I Googled Commodore PET, and Google tells me I have about 9,200,000 hits for that search. Now, I'm telling you, that's not very effective. I don't think there's 9 million sites out there that are going to give me good info on the Commodore PET.
Whereas on Yahoo.com, Commodore PET only returns 1.2 million results. So that's much more convenient.
Yes. See how it narrowed it down? That's an order of magnitude right there, man.
I just did the search. Yeah.
Excellent. Very good.
Yeah, I mean, even if you put Commodore, I mean, again, as an example, if you put Commodore PET in quotes, which will keep it together, they're not going to tell you about, you know, Commodore Johnson from World War II and his pet monkey. right. You've got
which you're lost.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a story that's worth its own podcast episode. But even with the quotes, it says about 306,000 results. I mean, again, the pet was a notable machine, but I, you know.
But there's no way. So there you go. I don't know why we lost that either. Maybe the web just got too big, kind of the exponential explosion
exactly
of web.
And web rings will solve this problem.
Bring them back.
Commodore web
ring. Yeah. I never really used web rings. I kind of knew what they were. Nope. I would maybe click.
I saw them, but I don't think I ever clicked on one.
Yeah.
I did.
I think I'm more interested in them now. I'm more likely to go and explore this web ring now than I was back then.
Yeah,
I seem to remember they were really handy for electronic stuff too, not just retro computing. You know, so different technical type hobbies, they would help you find those where, you know, just generic searches weren't very effective.
Yeah. Mm. Well, and if there wasn't anything to search, I mean, like, you know, if it was sort of pre-Google or, you know, like whoever just happened to submit to the directory at Yahoo.
Mm-hmm.
So. And they're sort of vouched for in a light way. I mean, so.
Yeah.
Okay. We can move on, I guess, to Carrington. You have interviews and things.
Oh, sure. Right. Yes. I've got a book and an article and an interview, like all about the same thing, the story of Ed Smith. This seemed to pass me by when it came out. The book was published, I think, in January is this year, but it's not super recent, about Ed Smith, who's one of the first African Americans to work in the design of video games. And he's one of the people behind the Imagination Machine, which we've mentioned before. So there was like the game thing, which he was also part of. He's an engineer that did the M1000, MP1000, whatever it was called. And that was like the game machine that got And then the Imagination Machine was the keyboard and the tape player thing, the base system that you'd put the game player in to turn it into a big computer. And which would be a neat thing in the mid-80s, but this is from the late 70s, so it's like remarkable. And so just like the coolest thing, I've always really liked it. It's just like the neatest thing. It's MP1000. So the MP1000 in Imagination Machine. And so this is the story of this guy. So so he's a complete pioneer in computers and video games, and he's a person of color. And so that just seemed like, hey, this is a time where this kind of stuff is on everybody's mind. And for some reason, I didn't know about this guy at all. And I have ordered the book, but I haven't received it yet, but I'm super interested in reading it. So I'm going to check that out. And I ordered the real physical book instead of the Kindle book because I got somebody else who wants to borrow it from me after that. So I'm going old school with the book, but old school stuff. So I'm really excited to hear this guy's story. So he's Ed Smith. And then in addition to that, in kind of looking about that and going down the rabbit hole, then I found an article written by Benj Edwards. Everything by Benj you should just read. And it's in Fast Company about Ed Smith. So that's given me, so I read that and that's given me kind of a primer about this guy, made me all the more excited to read the book. And then I found a video interview with him that's just on YouTube. So we're going to link to that as well. So I got a book, I got an article, I got a video, and I clearly got a lot of passion for this guy and I'm really excited about it. And I like the Imagination Machine. My memory is the Imagination Machine was unfortunately not a huge success. I think because it was something like $800 or something in like 1977 dollars for the one part. It's like a $7,000 computer thing nowadays. And so I think that probably priced it out. And just like reading all this stuff, reading about how at the company, APF, where this was made, they had an amazing diverse bunch of people that were working on this. Like it was just like such a different culture. And he came from like basically what he calls a ghetto in Brooklyn, but then just became a software engineer. And there was this amazing company that was super diverse and just like had tons of different people working in it. But really didn't, like the senior management really didn't get this whole idea of like creative stuff kind of happens when it happens. So you got Atari being all like sexist and awful, but also having parties and working on weekends and doing all that kind of stuff. And then they take over the industry. And they got APF saying, no, we're going to be really open and everybody's, and we're going to hire people and it's going to be this amazing inclusive places, but you will work from 9 to 5 Monday to Friday because that's how things are done. And it really wasn't like a creative culture. So it's so weird how different companies worked in different ways. And I hadn't really heard about this company. I hadn't heard about this guy. And I was super excited about all of this. So I thought I'd bring it to everybody else's attention too, because maybe other people don't know about him. And I think he sounds like just a radically cool guy. So I'm interested in reading about his story.
Interesting.
So that's what I got.
Well, and maybe I didn't hear this when you were talking about this before, but this he wrote the book himself. It's an autobiography.
It's his book, yeah, called Imagine That, the story of Ed Smith, one of the first African-Americans to work in the design of video games and personal computers.
Yeah.
And in fact, he wrote the book, and the preface to the book is by Benj Edwards. Yep. So, although, like I said, the book came out, I think, January. Anyways, it's this year. It's a new book. I missed it when it came out.
Yeah, January 23rd, 2020, according to Amazon.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, well, there you go. Okay.
Yeah, interesting. It is interesting that given what you just said about the culture of this place that they called the machine the Imagination Machine.
Right, exactly. But you will have imagination from 9 to 5 Monday to Friday because that's when it gets done. And the Imagination Machine itself is a really cool thing. Like a lot of people might not. We've talked about it before, I'm sure. But it's an obscure, weird thing. That's like a computer that has a whole part where you put like an Atari, like an entire Atari kind of into it. And that's your game machine. And I think one of the downsides to it was it had a built-in cassette player. But when it came out, it was right at that cusp where things, especially in North America, moving away from cassettes and to floppies. And so it was kind of bad that it had a built-in cassette player. But still, this thing that was this whole hybrid that was a cartridge-based game player and also a full computer and had a built-in cassette, like just so many cool things being done like just very originally in the 1970s. And so I'm just very, very passionate to know more about this guy's story.
Cool. Yeah.
I've heard I subscribe to a few physical magazines still, you know, the kind that on paper and they mail it to your house.
The kind that when you do this, it doesn't zoom.
Yeah. If you do this, it just creates a hole.
You zoom by using your face.
Closer, bring it closer, and then you know, take your glasses off. The Retro Gamer magazine is one that's been around for now, like almost 20 years, 18 years. This fellow here and there, like he's repeatedly popped up, just little bits of history, like with projects that intersected with the company that he worked for and different things he did, kind of tributes. But it's never been really an in-depth. And in fact, I would bet money that there is an in-depth look at the gentleman in one of the magazines that I haven't seen yet. But anyway, I've seen him pop up a lot of different little places, you know, talking about video gaming history. And I definitely intend to read the book now that you made me aware of it.
The weird thing was when you said Retro Gamer has been around for ages, I'm like, no, that's new. So I looked it up. I said, well, no, it started in 2004. And then I thought, oh, that's 16 years ago. How can 2004 be 16 years ago? Have I been in a coma?
That moments like that are
what?
So much more frequently for me. It's insane.
I just had a real mind melt. I even put my calculator. I'm like, no, this can't be right. It can't be. How does numbers work? No, there must. Anyway, that's weird. So soon there has to be retro gamer where it discusses right. Like early retro gamer magazines. But that's crazy that's 16 years. I am so old. Awesome.
Yeah.
New personal best. New high score for Carrington.
Paul, did you just get struck by lightning?
I didn't. Well, I don't know. I did actually lose the internet there for a moment.
So I heard an enormous crash.
Yeah.
Yep. You weren't missing anything.
Yeah.
Like explosion of, yeah.
But yeah, it came at a time when it kept me from saying the comment about the, you know, this sort of rigid environment and the imagination, you know, calling this thing the imagination machine, and it reminding me of people saying similar things about if you have to use the word science in the name of your discipline, then you are not a science. Social science and political science. And
so I studied physics science, right?
But thanks. Anyway, yeah. The thunder stole my snark.
Stole your thunder is yes. The phrase you're looking for.
Now I guess we can move to Earl and the mini pet.
Oh, okay. So the future was 8-bit in combination with Time Mouth Software came out with a new project. Is it still in pre-order status? Or no, it says the first batch are now shipping. It's yep. Awesome.
You can add to cart.
So what this is a functional reproduction of the pet. It's not identical to the pet. It has some more modern chips in it. Like, I think it's not a 6502 exactly. It's a more modern rev of the 6502. All of the components on here, if I remember correct, are obtainable today. So they're modern pieces, which is really kind of cool. Means that your things like supply chain for these components is not as likely to be interrupted as if you're trying to scavenge old new in-box stuff.
Right. Okay. So we won't need that new operating system. Yeah.
Collapse OS.
Right. You won't need Collapse OS.
Supply chain collapse. Yes.
So what else do I want to say about this? It's available in two forms. Kit A is if you want a standalone unit. So you notice that you've got the mini pet up here at the top, and then below it, you've got a keyboard with a bunch of these little tactile switches in the same layout as what you would have on the original Commodore PET. So
did you use the word keyboard in quotes there?
Yeah, exactly.
Because this is for, like, if people thought the original
board.
PET keyboard was right. Too comfortable.
Then this is what you need. Yeah.
Right.
If it was just too easy to type. On the 2001.
So technically a keyboard.
But there's also a kit B, which is the more interesting one for me personally, because this is, again, the mini PET on the top, but also some additional circuit cards that you can use to interface with an actual PET. So let's say that you have a PET, but it doesn't work. You want to completely replace what's under the hood while keeping what is on top of the hood, your CRT and your keyboard and that kind of thing. You can buy this board and these connecting boards. You can put it in and you can bring an old PET chassis back to life and still be functionally equivalent with the PET. Runs
How
the PET software. You notice it's even got the connectors like you find on the PET, the IEEE connector, the user port connector, the cassette connector. So I think this is just an amazing
project. How is it powered?
Well, two different ways. If you get the kit A, which is the standalone, then I think you power it with 5 volts, if I remember right. Maybe I'm wrong. You can see over here on the right. You see over here on the right of the mini PET, there is a barrel jack power connector. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember what voltage you put in here, but basically you power it itself. But if you get the kit B, then you actually power it from the PET's internal power supply. That's what some of this interconnecting stuff is all
about. Okay, so if you've got a PET and it's not working, but it's got to be not working not because of the power supply.
That's right. It has to be working, the board or whatever. Not working okay. Because of the logic board.
Right.
Yep. Which is actually pretty likely, but because the power supply on a PET was a pretty simple set of parts. I mean, maybe it could break down, but I'm recalling just a transformer, a smoothing capacitor, and a rectifier. A voltage regulator. I don't think it's very complicated. Sure, I mean, it could break, but it's more likely that probably some of the RAM on your PET broke or some of the other chips on the logic board. So you get this, bring it back to life.
Until someone uses the killer poke.
Right.
There was a YouTube video about that recently, mm-hmm. where they kind of a MythBuster sort of thing on the killer poke. I'm yet to watch it, but I want to see if that was real or not. Uh-huh. I think the actual MythBusters should get a Commodore PET and see if they can do the killer poke. I think that would break all their ratings records.
Yes, in some direction, I'm sure.
Exactly. Floor or ceiling, it still broke a record.
Something is breaking. So interestingly, both Kit A and Kit B are the same price.
That's right. And I actually wrote in and asked about that. Mm-hmm. I said, is this correct? And they said it is, because the cost of the interface boards on the Kit B and the cost of that tactile push-button keyboard that you saw on Kit A were actually close enough where it just kept things more simple to keep a unified price.
Interesting. And then there's an option to add in the SD to PET adapter thingy as well.
That's right.
Nice.
Which would really, really future-proof you. I mean, you would have a totally brand new, not new old stock, but new in box Commodore PET.
This is a very cool project. I dig it. Nice find.
Yeah. And not super expensive.
I don't think so. Even if you just want to build your own retro computer kit, you know, if you didn't have a specific interest in the PET, but you wanted to build a functional kit that where there's a community and some software out there, I think it is a good find.
All right. Let's see. So I have the next thing. And the next thing that I have is it's an article called The Mysterious Origins of an Uncrackable Video Game. It's an article that's on the BBC site. And it is...
It's fascinating.
It's really interesting, yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I read the paper related to it, and this is amazing.
Yeah, so, I mean, and so actually, Carrington, you might know it better than I do, but...
Well, I only read it because you found it. Yeah. You put it in the show notes, and I was like, what is this?
So there's a game called Entombed that was released in 1982 for the Atari 2600, and it's not a particularly well-known game. But, you know, part of what you do in this game is you navigate a maze, right? And the trick about the Atari 2600 is that there's very little to work with in terms of resources. So, there's essentially no space to keep an entire, like, big maze map. And this particular game would generate the maze kind of as you went through it. But the trick with one of these is that you don't want to generate a maze that you can't solve. So the problem is that, you know, you have 128 bytes or whatever of RAM and, you know, like no space anywhere, and you have to sort of procedurally generate this maze. And so what we're looking at here is basically it's kind of like a public report of a study that was done by, let's see, I forget now who, John Aycock and somebody, Tara Copplestone. So John Aycock from the University of Calgary in Canada, and Tara Copplestone from the University of York in the UK. And they were basically looking at this game to try to figure out what's going on with this maze generation algorithm, and they couldn't figure it out. I mean, like, it works, but they couldn't quite pin down like what the theory is behind it. Like, why does it always generate a maze that you can solve? And so it's really kind of like this deep dive into this algorithm to try to figure out, like, you know, what is going on. So that's the, you know, the reference here to the Uncrackable video game doesn't have to do with like digital rights management. It actually has to do with like understanding the logic of this game. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if they actually managed to talk to I think they did talk to the person who wrote it.
Yeah, there was a few people who wrote the game, and really, I would strongly suggest our listeners read the actual academic paper. It is so fascinating. Uh-huh. But yeah, they reached out and they talked to, I think there were three people that were in the part of the development team. And even in the article, it talks about how you have to be careful when you're talking to developers from so many years ago, because there can be a tendency to inflate one's own, like, I wrote all that. And like, everybody's saying they always wrote all the code. Mm-hmm. And memories can be faulty. And again, just like, so you have to kind of approach it not that even though they're a primary source, they're not a trustworthy primary source.
Yeah.
So I found that really fascinating. I never really even thought of that before. But they talked about how you can find like bits of code, and code has a fingerprint to it. You can look at things that are reused. And so they say, well, here's the code for this part of the game. And then we can find that. And they reverse engineer all the game. And then they say, we can find that same code in other games. We look at, well, who worked on those games? And so this same person worked on all these five of these games, and that code is used in all of those. And these other people worked on it, but it's not used there. So this is most likely by that person. Like, I never even thought about that kind of stuff before. And with the, with the maze algorithm, like, I had assumed when they started talking about how, okay, there, it's just, you know, the whole racing the beam thing with the Atari 2600, having to try to keep up with things so quickly, that if you do a maze game, you would use Eller's algorithm. That's one of the, like, there's lots of algorithms for generating mazes. Mm-hmm. It's like when you study computers, they just kind of teach you these things. And one was, I'm hoping I get this right, there's Eller's algorithm, which is one of the ones that's really, really fast, and it kind of generates a line at a time. So you can do an infinitely large maze in a linear time. Like, it doesn't matter how big the maze is, it doesn't make it take longer, mm-hmm. because it's really just creating it on the fly as it goes. It uses these sets and says, okay, now draw this line and it'll have these holes, and draw this line and join those together. And it's just it's a neat maze algorithm that lets you do an infinitely long solvable maze. And so I would have assumed this uses that. But Eller's algorithm was developed basically the same year this game came out, and it doesn't use that. Mm-hmm. It uses a different way to do basically the same thing, using a lookup table that nobody can figure out how they came up with this lookup table. Like, it's, you can do these things and you just look up the table and say, okay, use this bit next, but nobody yet can figure out, like, how did you make this table in the first place? And like, there's no algorithm. Like, what is this? It must have been handmade, but like, based on what theory? And nobody that was in the development of the game knows where the table came from, other than like the maze algorithm itself was supposedly created, they think, by this guy who was like a part-time employee or a contract employee who they said was either like drunk or high all the time. And then one night he said, oh, I just had this vision of how you do a maze. And then he just said, here. And then he kind of just vanished. They're like, where did this guy? The whole thing is fascinating. Yeah. Like, it's just like reading this story, I was like, there's so much more to this than I would have thought possible. It's exciting. It's interesting. It's still a mystery. Like, nobody really knows where this came from. It is an unbelievably fascinating read. So yeah, highly, highly recommend it.
Aliens, perhaps.
Wow. Yeah, it was a deep, deep rabbit hole that I was not anticipating. When you put the link on, I'm like, I'll start reading. I'm like, what is this? Great. Just if you're interested in reverse engineering stuff, or like where games come from, or game theory, or any of that, like, this just checks all the boxes in an academic paper of all things. Like, it is just fascinating. One thing you mentioned though, Paul, that I didn't think I would bring up, but I think I should, is you talked about how this wasn't really about like a DRM thing. Like, it's like Uncrackable, not in the sense that you can't crack and copy it, but Uncrackable and that nobody knows how it came about. But they do also in the paper address kind of DRM issues that I wouldn't have thought would be such a thing in an academic setting. But again, because DRM is always awful, it is. And so I pulled up the paper to say, so it says, Our work falls under research and education fair dealing exceptions, similar to the fair use in the United States, of the Copyright Act of Canada. However, this would not extend to distribution, meaning that it's not possible to share an archived binary of Entombed or its full disassembly. So they disassembled it, and the whole work is based on that disassembly, but they can't give you this, right, or like include it in the paper, because it would be now distributing the game technically. And so they say even linking to infringing material can run afoul of the law. And in any event, there are multiple locations for game images. So what they say is basically go get it. So it says instead, as the game's binary images are quickly found with internet search engines, we supply a means for ascertaining if a found image matches the one we used. And so then they give an MD5 checksum. So they basically
that's pretty cool.
Done this, released it to the wild, and said, well, if you happen to go find it, use this checksum and you know it's the one we're using. And I just thought it's really interesting that in an academic setting, like, this seems to be a way that one has to do this, to say, I want to discuss this thing. You should look at the thing. I can't give you the thing. Oh, the thing got out. If you use this, you'll know if you got the right thing. Yeah. Very fascinating. It didn't occur to me that that would be a problem. And I think that's likely something that is almost unique to digital archaeology. Like, this wouldn't be the case with something else. Like, you can discuss the Mona Lisa and include a reproduction of the actual Mona Lisa in your book, because it's, well, I'm not reproducing the painting, I'm reproducing it in an academic standpoint. But I guess when it comes to software, they say, oh no, somebody could then run this and then they have a version of it. I'm like, well, I've got a copy of the Mona Lisa too, I can cut it out of the book. Weird little hypocrisy there. All of this was news to me.
Yeah.
So anyway, fascinating deep rabbit hole. All of it is interesting.
Yeah. And I also wanted to mention, too, that John Aycock has – so he there's a book came out a little while ago called Retro Game Archaeology, you know, which is just sort of like a – this is basically what he's hired to do. You know, this is his job at university. He does retro game archaeology. And so there is an actual, you know, academic book
Cool.
That, you know, sort of talks about a lot of this sort of stuff. It is priced like academic books are priced.
Oh, that's yeah, cool.
At any rate. And also there's we'll put a link into him giving a talk on this stuff. So if you don't want to read the book, you can watch the movie.
Yeah. Cool. Oh, and they found a bug in the game. And this they talk about in the PRNG, the pseudo random number generator. They had found a bug in it, but it's so there's a bug in the maze generation as well. But it's random enough that nobody would notice, and the game stays playable. Mm-hmm. But that's just an interesting thing that came out of it. It's like, oh, and we've also spotted a bug, and then they tried to use that to figure out would anybody have known it, and like, so probably not. And then that helps them know that that's that exact code that they found in other games mm-hmm. that's been reused and clearly wasn't spotted by the person who created the software.
Mm, right.
And so it's no, but and it's such an easy to fix bug that clearly it could have been spotted. Otherwise the people who worked on it would have just corrected it, 'cause it's such an easy, and just like all these things, just like I swear every page unlocks like five or six really interesting concepts. I just can't express like how cool this article or this paper is.
And for somebody, this is their job.
Which I know that person has a much better job than I have. It's a great job. How did I get to have that job? I want that job. Anyway, it's fascinating.
Okay. And then, as it turns out, Carrington, you've put an extra link in the show notes. Did you want to talk about that as well?
Oh, sure, because, you know, I haven't gone on long enough. More right. Me, all me.
Mark Carrington.
This is a really quick one. Somebody's created a – I shouldn't say somebody. I should say their name, but I don't know whose name it is. Scroll, scroll, scroll. I don't know. Somebody, put your name on your websites. Has created a thing. It's Amper Commands for Apple II. So the Apple II, if you're working in BASIC, you can put machine language things in that you then use the ampersand little code that lets you access those. So it's a way to get machine language kind of speed and routines easily accessed from AppleSoft BASIC. Somebody's made a series of double low-res mode graphics ampersand library. So you can load this up, and then you can do like double low res is really cool. So it's the Apple IIe onward. So the Apple IIe enhanced. Mm-hmm. So the IIe enhanced, the 2C and the 2GS have this really cool graphics mode that's kind of unused and a bit of a pain to work with, especially within BASIC. But then this makes it really easy to work. So if you want to do a low res game and basically double your low res resolution to 80x48, you can now do it basically as easy as using the built-in stuff in AppleSoft just by using these commands. is dead. You just load this library and you're good to go with the two pages of double low res. So I thought it was really cool. So we'll link to that too. Yeah. I love that resolution because it's fast and it's like you can do a lot with 48 by 40. Like that's a good resolution that you can really make a neat game or something or whatever. So it really unlocks, I think, a lot of easy graphics power for people that just still want to work in basics.
Wait, are you saying that this ampersand is just part of AppleSoft?
Yeah, like so what you can do with AppleSoft, you can put things basically high level concept. You put machine language routines in certain places in memory, and then you can reference those using the ampersand command essentially. So it basically adds commands to AppleSoft. So in this case, for instance, you get there's normally the GR command to go to graphics. This is ampersand GR will then switch to the double low res mode, and you get ampersand VLIN instead of just VLIN in this case will give you plotting in this and the ampersand it just lets you create new commands that become valid AppleSoft tokens or keywords. So it's kind of the standard way to increase the functionality of AppleSoft Basic. It's a really cool and powerful thing.
Yeah, it's like a user hook of some kind. I mean, like essentially, you just say
that's
like,
what hook is the word I was looking for. Yeah,
like if when you hit the ampersand, when AppleSoft catches the ampersand, it'll jump to whatever address you set, and then the thing you send it to has to parse out like the next bit. So I used it a lot in modem drivers. So there would be a little ampersand A to answer the phone or ampersand B to dial or something like that.
It's kind of like a ampersand is kind of like a go sub. Mm-hmm. Jump to this part of memory. It's going to handle it, and then it'll come back to you later.
Yeah, that's cool, though.
So anyway, that's it. It's just cool, but it's cool because double low res is a really cool graphics mode, and I love that. Yeah, anything that's going to make it easier to work with that for people, I think, is awesome. So that's it. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. So if you're a basic developer for the Apple II, then this should excite you.
Yeah. When did this come out? I wonder if it's in time for Hackfest. It might be.
I know it was more than 2 weeks ago because this was going.
Oh,
we were
true.
Going to include it in the last show, so it's over 2 weeks ago. It was out because I had it in the show notes from then.
Cool.
I say that it is in time for Hackfest.
Okay. What we're talking about is that at Kansas Fest generally there's this programming contest that takes over the time of the duration of the event, but there are some restrictions on what you can use things that are in the public, available to the public. Within a certain time frame. So it had to, you can't just like write up a library and then release it the day before Hackfest starts. It has to be sort of available to everybody.
Because it kind of makes it unfair. Yeah. Because it's like you've got a thing that nobody else could have had access to.
Okay. I think we made it. So now a word from our sponsor.
A major milestone for us was when we were walking through Harvard Square one time and saw this popular electronics magazine. And it was kind of, in a way, good news, bad news. Here was someone making a computer around this chip in exactly the way that Paul had talked to me, and we thought about what kind of software could be done for it. And it was happening without us. And for all we knew, maybe they had some software people. They were just going to go charge off and do this thing. And so we wrote this company immediately. And offered to do a basic for them. And they thought that was interesting. They called back and said, well, you're serious. We have a lot of strange people calling us. Because this article received immense interest. I mean, the idea of a kit computer, even though there was really nothing you could do with it. I mean, there's no teletype hookup in the early days. There's no software for it. All you could do is use these switches. Actually, use them here. And key things in. Into this front panel and maybe do a little program that does things in the lights. Or actually a guy named Steve Dompier discovered that because this bus is unterminated, if you're very clever about the program you run, you can get high frequency emission that can cause a radio to make interesting noises. Now eventually we did get controllers for teletypes and cassette tapes and floppy disks, that kind of thing. But in the early days, it's pretty useless. People just bought it thinking that it would be neat to build a computer. I stayed up all night reading the book to see if we'd miscoded some of the instructions and finally decided it was all okay, punch out the paper tape, and made sure Paul got that before he went off on his plane. He wrote the bootstrap loader That is the thing you have to key in to make this computer smart enough to know to go get data off the teletype to read it into memory. He wrote that on the plane on the way out. It was actually 46 bytes, the first one. I eventually wrote one in 17 bytes, but anyway. And he took the BASIC to MITS. They had a machine they had run with 6K of memory, which for them was a big, big thing. Loaded it up in the paper tape. The first time, for some reason, it didn't work. The second time, they loaded in, and it worked. And, of course, the simulator, it's very slow because you go through lots of instructions to a single instruction. So actually, the real machine, even though it's such a simple little microprocessor, was faster than our PDP-10 simulator, about five times faster. And so to Paul, when it finally came up and it said, okay, actually that first version said ready. Most BASICs, when they're ready, they say ready. Later when I was squeezing bytes out, I thought, well, it's faster to print okay, and it's kind of a nice, friendly word, so I shortened it to okay a little later. Anyway, so it came up, said ready, and he typed in a program. You know, print 2 plus 2, it worked. He had it print out squares and sums and things like that. And he and Ed Roberts, the head of this company, sat there, and they were amazed by, you know, that this thing worked. I mean, Paul was amazed that our part had worked, and Ed was amazed that his hardware worked, and that here it was doing something even useful.
And we're back. So this time, the host's retro computing gift idea is perhaps, I don't know if this is very creative, but at any rate, we're trying to think of what would be a good and timely thing to do for a gift idea. And the idea we had was to register somebody for Kansas Fest 2020. So this is, we've talked about this repeatedly. The registration now is, I think it's just about to 400. I mean, like, so this is a thing that usually happens in a dorm in Kansas City, Missouri, and it has sometimes gotten right around 100. But now that it's virtual this year, that it's being held virtually, the registration has shot up to 370 or something so far. So what that means, by the way, is that if you give this gift to someone right away, they will get a commemorative pin. But we only got 400 of those pins. So after that, you can still register, but you will not get the pin. And there's a shirt that goes along with this. Blake was modeling the shirt on our stream. So the registration is not... It's a $20 registration. It doesn't include the shirt, but it does include the pen if you're early enough in it. And basically what it will do is entitle you to be in the communication channels for the talks and things and stuff. So there's technologically this is going to take place on a Discord, if that is meaningful to people. So that will be a place where you can ask questions during the talk and where you can... sort of after hours have chats with people and stuff like that. So that's it. That's the gift idea for this time. It is a $20 registration for yourself or the person you're trying to convince to become a retro computing enthusiast.
As they should. So you guys, you're all registered? Everybody else on the show? I am.
Ready to go.
I am registered. I threatened to register my daughter, but she threatened me with various harm options, and so she didn't want it. She didn't want it recorded, in a log somewhere that she had attended Kansas Fest.
Yeah, they can
because we heard her employment.
They can find out that stuff
I
later.
To register her silently, without. I won't tell her, but I'll know.
Do it quick so you can get a pin.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think semi-seriously. There probably would be certain ways that you could use kind of like a throwaway email address to get at the Discord. But if you don't want your name to be public, it doesn't have to be public. It is possible for you to follow along and so forth without necessarily advertising.
I think it's always been the case, at least as far as I can remember, that when you register, it even says, like, hey, can we use your name and stuff and things? And you could just uncheck that. Yeah, that's the thing about Kansas Fest. In all seriousness, it's always been... all retro things are so just like it's all white guys, but like Kansas Fest is still, it seems to be a thing that's always tried to be really inclusive and try to say like, hey, if somebody else wants to come in, they have difficulty with stairs. We're like, okay, we can get you on the ground floor. Or somebody says, I have difficulty with noise. Great, we got a quiet section. I want to feel safer doing this. Great. I don't want my photo taken. Great, we'll have different color badges. Like, it does seem to have always been this thing that's really trying to be more inclusive mm-hmm. than your typical nerd gathering. And I've always really liked that about it. So it is unsurprising that the Cancer Fest, of course, has a checkbox that says, like, I don't want my name shown. Great, no problem. Yeah. Like, just, it's really good about that. I dig it. I mean, there's obviously problems with every gathering of nerds always. But Cancer Fest really tries to be better than most. I like it.
Well, I'm looking forward to this. This will be my first year, but again, it's quite a bit lower bar to attendance as far as yeah. the Trek out. I look forward. I hope and I imagine that, you know, it will be one day back as a physical gathering. And because right now this is, I guess, Kansas Fest, from what I've heard online, would be Kansas Fest without the funk.
Right.
Left home the funk.
I think the song was even written about it, if I'm not mistaken.
There was indeed a K-Fest funk song. Yeah, Dr. Steve.
Part of the reason my daughter does not look forward to the potential of attending. She was like, I don't know, Dad, you talked about that funk that they were talking about. I'm sure that's not anything, but yeah.
And it's a Friday and Saturday is the virtual one, right? Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yep, and I took the Friday off.
Yeah, it's pretty short.
Oh, I'm 100% taking Friday off. All I'm doing that Friday and Saturday is Kansas Fest. I'm just going to – can't wait.
I'll do the same.
One thing that's going to be sort of interesting about this is that because not everybody's going to be in Kansas City, there's pretty wide distribution of time zones. So I think there are going to be – you know, it's going to be arranged in a way that's kind of – mostly reasonable if you are in North America. It's going to be rough for the Australians. But
yeah, I mean, yeah.
So it goes.
But Kansas Fest has always had super late night hangout things. There's no reason why it can't be for this too.
It'd be funny to do a group video call with 400 people. Everybody gets 20 pixels.
Yeah. Everybody wave. Oh, it's okay. Like, you did. All right.
It's like a collage.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so we can, I guess, move on to... So after you've paid for your registration fee.
You can buy stuff on eBay.
Let's see. So with that, we can now turn to our eBay auctions.
I'll move quickly through this. Speaking of lapel pins, here is a pin that might catch the eye of a item collector out there. It's I know Lotus back was famous with 123. They created for the Mac a spreadsheet which may have had an integrated database called Jazz. Does anyone recall? I think it was Mac only. Yeah, it's a lapel pin that is designed like a brass Jazz pin. It has the logo, and it is being sold for $22,219. And
it's a deal.
Is it made out of actual jazz? Do I get like the origin of the music? What the heck?
I think I don't think there's a metal that possibly could, could justify.
Is it a lot larger than it looks? Like, it shows up and it's like, where do you want us to back up this pin?
Indeed. I remember, I humorously recall this was an ad for Jazz, and I recall reading a review of the software, and the author of the review was unimpressed, and he said it seems more likely in this picture of a gentleman excitedly leaping, having recently used Jazz, that he's more likely sustained some form of injury. Jazz not to be up to the muster of what it was intended. But anyway, I just happened to remember that image, so I thought I'd bring it on.
That is funny. Retro burn.
At any rate, yeah. So it looks like it's only $8 shipping. He didn't go free shipping on this one. Like,
come on.
Like, you'd think free shipping would have been a nice touch. But anyway, and also the seller refers to it as Verbatim Jazz. Now, Verbatim was a magnetic media company. I know Lotus is the company that created Jazz. I'm not sure what that means. But anyway, it was the price of this that caught my attention. It is sealed, so it's never been worn before. And I don't know how it compares to the Kansas Fest pin. I don't have that in my mind.
It's a lot more expensive, I'll tell you that. It's true.
Yeah. So anyway, that's kind of a fun one there.
The Jazz logo, which kind of hard to describe. Like it's a skinny J and then a normal A and then a big skinny Z and then a little Z. That style. So think of that style from the 80s where everything's kind of all mixed up all over the place, or the look of things from Task Times and Toontown. So you've got everything all over the place and weird colors. And all those, like, oh, here's going to be my desk, and it's going to have a three normal legs and then a big red wheel on this side. That's a design style that literally, like, 4 hours ago, I learned had a name, and it's the Memphis Group. There was an actual company that developed this, not Memphis, UK. It's like a Memphis part of Italy, and it's actually, like, was one particular company came up with this style. They still exist, and it's the Memphis Group. And I never knew that that's what it's called. So if you ever want to refer to that kind of style of things, it's the Memphis Group of architecture or graphics design.
I did not know, but I've seen, as you said, there's several different things that I've encountered that have that style.
Pee-wee's Playhouse, like you got that weird kind of explosion of color. Turns out it's a thing. I was just thought it was like, you know, it's 1980s. Nope. Turns out it's a particular design group came up with that particular style. And then a lot of people ripped it off. But being the 80s. So.
Distinctive.
Yep.
All right. So I'll move on. That's just kind of a silly one. Well, who knows? Maybe someone's dream will have come true when they bid and win this thing. But another item that caught my attention was the Timex FDD 3000 computer. Now, I saw this. It's sort of a striking image. Scrolling through eBay, it looks like a kind of like a PC clone box. It's black with two three-inch or 3.5-inch disk drives. I'm not sure if they're those strange 3-inch mini disks or 3.5-inch micro floppies. But the computer seemed odd because I thought I was aware of all the Timex computers. You know, Timex did the American run of Sinclair computers. There was a 2068 computer, the silver computer that was basically a ZX Spectrum that wasn't actually compatible with the ZX Spectrum unless you had a cartridge aftermarket. Anyway, so I looked into it. It's selling for $2,500, original box, good shape and working, but I didn't really know much about it. And again, it looks like a computer, and they call it a computer, but it also has a what looks like the standard ZX Timex rear interface attach unit that would slot into the back of a existing computer. So I read more about it. Apparently, it's a second take on an upgrade, a disk drive upgrade for the Timex the 2048 or 2068, and these are again the American takes on the ZX Spectrum. You can plug it into the back and use it as a floppy drive interface and storage unit for one of these Timex computers, or you can feed, apparently there's something called a Timex Terminal 3000, which I guess is kind of a dumb term, or maybe a Sinclair that does nothing except, you know, it's like a serial terminal or some such.
So a Sinclair.
come on now. And if you hook this up to the thing and a monitor, it will run CPM. Like it needs to boot, but it's a machine capable of running CPM without a host unit, or with a host unit that's not really doing anything, or it can serve as a disk drive unit for someone that's using a Spectrum as a Spectrum, which seemed kind of strange to me. I'd never heard of this thing. I'd never seen it before.
Me neither.
And it's a computer, and it's also not a computer. So that kind of caught my attention. Has anyone heard of this?
Never.
No.
No.
And I'm sure I would remember because it looks like a computer that comes with a ham radio microphone.
Yeah.
It does. And, you know, I mean, Timex, you know, there weren't many of these, you know, Timex branded computers. So I'm a little shocked that I've not encountered it anywhere, given that I'm in the States and this is a thing in the States.
Hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, so it's $2,500, $50 shipping. And yeah.
The only thing I don't like about this, I mean, this is really cool because I never heard this before, but I don't like that they're using a stock photo instead of the actual computer.
Mm-hmm. Here at the main auction photo?
Yeah, at the main auction photo. So, you know, it says the photo is not from my item, small scratches only. So they've shown you a photo, but that's not the actual computer getting. Like, why wouldn't you take a photo of the actual computer?
Especially at $2,500.
Exactly. Yeah.
You should have a photo of the actual thing.
I didn't even notice that. So If I was buying, I guess you'd, you know, dig into all the weeds.
Sure, and you'd ask somebody for a photo or whatever. But anyway, it's cool. I've never heard of it before.
Yeah, no, I'd never encountered it anywhere. I mean, the Timex Spectrum things in America are weird enough to begin with, you know, but that didn't really catch on so much. But all right, and the last thing I have is this is a kind of a striking item. It is a vintage 1987 Medical Graphics Microloop 1100 spirometer, Apple IIe many cards.
What is this?
It's clearly, it's one of the later model Apple Platinum Apple IIes with the number pad. It's sitting in some sort of a, it looks like someone took a, inserted a 2E, a disk drive, and a monitor into a war game style missile silo control deck. Mm-hmm. And basically that's what it looks like. You've got one disk drive, a monitor, the 2E, you can see from the picture, there's no cover on the 2E slot bays. If you look on the back, there's a, air, flow tube and a spirometer, for those unaware, is a medical device that is able to determine how much, air you're able to move.
I think when you take like an asthma test, that,
yeah, thing, that, right? That, yeah, that sort of thing. So this looks like it's around back. There's this tube, that presumably the patient would blow in, Medical Graphics Corporation label on the back. Here we see a picture of it without the protective cover. It's basically, you know, a vertical table with a 2E and a, accessories. And around back, there's a shot of the 2E. It's just a standard 2E. Sitting in this enclosure, and it's full of cards, and the description explains that it's loaded with the following cards. It has 80 column RAM expansion, an AppleCAT 2 modem, an expansion card for 1200 baud, a microbuffer 2, a disk 2 card, a interactive structure A113-A 16 channel AD card. One was used on the space shuttle. I don't know if they used one in a 2E on the space shuttle, how they would use that if it wasn't in a 2E on the space shuttle, or that seemed a curious detail to me. At any rate, it also has a Titan accelerator. It's a 6502 accelerator and a Titan RAM expansion. So anyway, apparently they were able to get it to boot partially, but you know, it belonged to a collector who's downsizing, and it was a consignment sale. No guarantee of functionality because electronics can fail at any time, but it does look like the picture shows it with, you know, something on the screen.
Hmm.
And it's an interesting thing. Medical Graphics Corporation is the company that it has the label and the logo, but I don't know if Medical Graphics, if what it does when you blow through this tube is it visually plots some sort of a scenario that's graphic related to your output capacity. But anyway, it's surely a striking and unusual usage of a 2E, at least in my opinion. So this one, yeah, just the sight of it caught my attention. It goes for $4,999 and is free local pickup. So
this is very, very cool. I've never seen this, anything like this before. It looks like, you know, in time travel books that always say you got to worry about, like, if you travel back in time, you might end up inside a tree. It's like somebody sent their Apple II back in time and ended up inside a medical device thing, because it's just like half of an Apple II sticking out the front of another thing. This is very cool.
Yeah, that's well put. Yeah, very strange. And, you know, the you can see the faceplate. You know, the disk drive cutout,
yeah,
enclosure perfectly fits this particular unidisk, you know, so it's a clearly a you know, precision design.
It would be a cool way to just use an Apple II, even if you couldn't get it working. Like, if just to have an Apple II working this way, mm-hmm, it's just really neat.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a cutout just above the disk drive for a second disk drive too.
Yes. Yes. And I presume there's some knobs above. Presumably those are to do with the, you know, the air input or output. It was a curious
thing.
Yep. So that was, that's my eBay selection. So there we go.
Yeah. I guess I think of this as being something a little bit like what you could these days use a Raspberry Pi or an Arduino or something for, you know, like it's sort of like you pick up the brain and you put it in your device. And,
right,
you know, the brains of the times were Apple IIes.
Mm-hmm.
But, mm-hmm.
Yeah, this cool. Must have been from some time ago. I guess this Platinum 2E of this sort, came out in very end of the 80s, I guess, or maybe the early 90s. Probably very late 80s. I know this was the last Apple II produced.
Yeah.
Was the Platinum wide Apple II, the 2E with the number pad.
All right. Carrington, you have the next thing.
Oh, yeah. I've got just a really quick one. And I've shared the screen here for people to look at home. So it's The Works, which is like a Works software thing. We all know kind of what that concept is. But I don't know this one. Paul probably has 17 of these. But this struck me as kind of weird because it says a complete collection of home software. It's still sealed. It's by First Star Software. Mm-hmm. So I know them because they did BoulderWorks, Boulder Dash. Anyway, that one. One of those ones. So we talked about a while, a couple episodes ago, how that it's a game that Blake doesn't like. And so I guess maybe that was why it was on my mind. But I didn't know they did Works software. And this is interesting because it's The Works by one particular person, this Fernando Herrera. And it's just neat. So it's Works software. It's got a letter writer, loans investment calculator, weights measure, blah, 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 typing teacher, graphics painter, music composer, like a whole bunch of stuff by what I think of as a pretty famous Apple II games developer. But it's this Fernando Herrera. It's $100. It's still sealed. Do any of you know this software? Have you seen it before? Do you have it? How many copies do you have, Paul?
I do not have it. I have seen, I think, this listing before, but I mean, apart from that, I don't think I've seen it.
And didn't tempt you to buy it then?
I don't know. No. in a way, it seems a little bit unfair. It wouldn't be interesting to use. It doesn't seem fun. And so I am kind of predisposed not to get it, even though, I mean, like, you know, it might well be unpreserved.
Okay. Oh.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, no, I certainly didn't know people using it in the day.
Well, anyway, that's what I got. We're going to have couple of links in the show notes as well for people to look at. I found the First Star software still exists and is still making software, so that's cool. So we'll have a link to them in case you want to see what they're up to now. And also, we were talking about Kay Savitz. He interviewed Fernando Herrera, turns out, and so I just found that, and we'll have the link to his interview in the show notes as well.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
All right.
Because they did, I think, Spy versus Spy. Like, I think of them as one of the game, for Apple II, but for other things, like a game publisher. Right. And then suddenly there's this Works by this particular person. I'm like, what is this? So anyway, that's it. I thought it was a neat find. $100. It's still sealed. Paul will eventually buy it, so don't worry about it.
Eventually.
Eventually.
All right, Earl, you have the next thing.
I got a couple quick things. So the first is a kit of parts to put together a CPU card for an Altair MITS 8800. And it looks like it goes to a printed circuit board that's not a part of the auction, but they reference that you can find it in the separate auction. I looked around and I didn't find the PC board that goes with this kit of parts, but I thought it was interesting that you can buy this kit and it's got all the pieces that you need to put together a CPU board for MITS 8800. So it's got a bunch of chips. If you zoom in for folks who are playing the home game, you can see that you've got some chip tubes here. They've got a variety of, looks like 7400 logic chips, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe that big tube is for the CPU. And then it's got a bunch of chip sockets that come with it. So you can have your chips socketed on this PC card. And it's got a number of the passive components like resistors and capacitors, that kind of thing. So that was my first auction. I thought it was kind of neat that you can actually build up a CPU card for one of the old S100 systems. And then the second thing that I had, and I stole this one from Paul, which is a Epson PX4. And for those of you who are good at math, PX4 is exactly half of PX8. So the more common Epson PX8 laptop, I've actually got a couple of those, bought them new in box from an outfit, I think it was in Colorado, that was selling them there for a while, that had shelves of them in a new inbox. The PX4 is a more obscure machine. It looks like a PX8, except it looks like the screen got cut in half. I think it's a 40-column by 8-line screen. And to make up for that, to the right of the screen, they have one of the little mini printers like they had on the Epson HX20. The keyboard and the function keys in that look very similar to what you find on a PX8 computer. I don't know as very much, actually, about this particular unit. I don't think that we had them at Epson before I actually left Epson. Don't remember the exact date. If I, they also mentioned for this particular auction that this was part of a bigger component. Let me see what they say here.
I see. Yeah, that's why I guess maybe why it's labeled as this like IVE thing.
They say it came in a big suitcase, weighed about 50 pounds. They've extracted the PX4 from the bigger unit that this was part of. So who knows? Maybe it was a another computer and a peak flow meter or something like that. Like that Apple II. And they mention also that along with the auction comes a couple of hard-to-find cables. And I will say that's true. For the PX4 and the PX8, there can be some cables that are difficult to find for those units. So it's kind of cool that it comes with those.
I wonder if I actually purchased a new inbox PX8 from the same place that you did, Earl, after you mentioned it on Retrobits podcast. I actually went out there and I didn't go out there. I called them up and ordered one. I don't know why I said I went out there, but presumably the PX4 also runs in a novel fashion CPM, I guess, because I know the PX8 very in a move that seems pretty curious to me, runs CPM. I wonder if the PX4 does as well.
You know, I think I remember that being the case, but I just can't say for sure.
Mm-hmm. They boot CPM off of a ROM chip, which is just interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's amazing. CPM 2.2 in ROM. So you just turn it on and boom, it's there. I'll look that up while we're going to the next ones. Mm-hmm. Make sure that that's the case.
The auction itself does claim that it's a CPM. I mean, a CPM machine.
And so does Wikipedia. Yeah. So, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. I know that I was aware of the existence of the PX4 and had looked around for them at some point. But I think this may be the first that I've seen. Anyway, cool. Is it me now? I think it might be me. The first thing that I wanted to just point out is that there's, you know, as I was looking through the eBay listings, I came across one of the gray bags that is designed for the Apple IIc. You know, so it's basically just the carrying bag for the Apple IIc. And I think it really does seem like we've gotten to a point where people don't know what these are anymore. So this particular one I had actually picked for the recording 2 weeks ago. And no one bought it, and it's still here. So it's in basically perfect shape. It's $25 starting bid, shipping from St. Paul. But, I mean, like, these, I would say these are worth more than that.
Yep. I had one for my 2C, and I definitely paid more than $25.
Yeah. The seller says, from my days selling Apple computers back in the 1980s. So this is somebody who should know what this is. But, you know, basically doesn't even mention the Apple IIc connection to it. So if you're searching for it, you wouldn't know how to find it. And there's another one that I found that's being sold as for a buy it now of $50. This one is listed as vintage Apple Macintosh computer briefcase. So again,
could be used for that.
I mean, you could use it for that, but it's more special than that. You know, it's designed for the 2C. So
this is how you get your 2C out to the beach.
That's right.
Exactly.
So anyway, I don't know how to suggest trying to find one of these since nobody knows how to list them. I guess you basically just search for anything that mentions Apple. But they're out there.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. Okay. The next thing I have, I thought this was just somewhat interesting. I guess it's a light pen. It's a Symtec light pen for Apple computers. It's from 1980, so it's a very sort of early light pen. But the thing that kind of caught my attention about it. So I mean, there's a couple, it's a light pen. It's kind of an interesting peripheral, but it was also packed in foam, and the foam has deteriorated badly. and I don't know if you,
like it was packed in blue flour.
Yeah. I mean,
looking at the image that you're showing on your screen, it sort of looks like an archaeological find that they chipped out of some sort of a loose sandstone and revealing the interface and the tape, the audio tape that teaches you how to use it, presumably.
It's very, so the problem is, of course, when these were new, the foam was nice and it contained everything and protected everything. And, I've had a couple of things that are like this where it's just sort of turned to sand. And it's quite sad.
As a seller, you might go ahead and abandon the foam despite its original purpose, given that it's turned into such a nightmarish sort of alternate substance.
I'm not tempted to pay more for it because it has the original foam. I'm tempted to say this looks like garbage. How about less than $80?
Yeah, I'd take the compressed air to that, maybe.
I have something that's it's a like a voice recognition card that's a little, that you plug into your Apple II and it's got a little headset and stuff like that. And it's packed much the same way as this. I mean, like I have it, it's in a box full of foam and I just, it's all deteriorated and I don't want to even think about it. It's, someday I'm going to get to it, but it's going to be a big mess. Anyway, so I kind of wanted to just sort of point out what happens to foam. Anyway, okay, so let's see what's next. Next thing I have is a TRS-80 Model 3 in its box, so all ready for zombie smashing. But anyway, I thought it was kind of neat to see it in its box. It has a little foam. This is actually sort of intact foam, different kind of foam, it's sort of holding it in place, and has some original cassettes and things with it.
It looks like it doesn't have the floppy drives. It was the model that came without the floppy drives.
Interesting.
You either use cassette or buy the floppy enhancement.
Oh, look at that.
I had not noticed that.
Well spotted.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting.
I didn't even know there was a version that didn't come. I thought they all came with at least one.
There's actually a version that they make that looks functionally identical to this, I think. But instead of the two drive bays, it's just like one long... It looks like a speaker grill, and it has the logo in the middle. And what it is, it may lack the cassette port, but what it is, it's a straight up dumb terminal. Like,
huh. Oh, right, I remember that one.
Yeah, they. It looks kind of nice because that whole side is a tall, very much like a metal speaker cover, and it's just meant as a terminal.
It seems like at the very least they could have just made it like a glove compartment or something, like a place where you could put stuff, just not just seal it off. Anyway, what I thought was kind of interesting about this is just, seeing the original box, because it's not, it's not an interesting box, but it is nevertheless the box.
I think $299 seems pretty reasonable for that. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's in pretty good shape.
Yeah, it may not ship, so you have to be sort of within reach of New Britain, Connecticut to get it. But,
oh, for local pickup. That's maybe not such a bad idea anyway, because I've heard some, especially the bigger all-in-one systems with CRTs, I've heard serious horror stories about...
I have a Model 4, and when the Model 4 came, the guy had all the original brown, the nice brown vinyl, books and manuals, and he packed it in there, and they were like above the keyboard, and... it ended up the weight of that in some move caused the circuit board under the keyboard to basically crack in half with the weight of that down. I repaired it with soldered jump lines, but it was a mess. These machines, that's a big, heavy machine.
And people will think the foam in the box is like shipping foam. So, it's got some padding. We're good. Not thinking that these boxes came in shipping containers.
Right.
They're not designed to ship on their own.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you look at this particular box, it doesn't, it's not protected much on the side. A little bit, I guess, but.
Well, you can just fill that with heavy books.
Yeah, apparently. Perfect. Maybe throw in a can of soda.
Make sure you shake it up first. It's better padding if you really shake it.
Some jacks. Really get the shrapnel going up there.
and then a glitter bomb.
Okay, so let's see. The next thing I will put is this. So I was just sort of, you know, going through eBay auctions, and this is it's Microsoft Office Standard Trade-Up Edition. This one's for Windows. It has Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and Mail in it. And basically, when I looked at this, I just thought, I just want to quit and go live on a mountain.
I read your description of the show notes. You linked this as Microsoft Office makes you want to stop collecting and go live in a cabin in the woods on a mountain.
Because they're so, I mean, like when I look, it's a cube of manuals. it's back, you know, from this bygone era when everything was just huge. So, you know, and also it's very mass produced, and it's just like I look at this and my energy just is sapped. it's kind of not fair, but anyway, I thought I would just share.
I have this one, and I'm part way through scanning the manuals. I couldn't keep this whole thing.
Halfway to the mountain.
Just like what you're saying, it is too gigantic.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, the one good thing was the documentation was really good.
Mm-hmm.
For these packages is just voluminous.
Yeah, I do have a couple of these sorts of things. I have like some Fox Pro sets and things, and it's tough to bring myself to scan it because it feels very mass produced. So it feels like how could this possibly not be scanned? But who is going to have scanned the Excel manual?
I didn't see it anywhere. I did take a look, because that's one of the things I look at before
time.
I go to the trouble of scanning something. If somebody else has already done it, then...
Right. Okay, and then I guess the last things I will mention in my little chunk here. Somebody is selling these two books that came with... They came with the original Apple IIs. The Apple II Reference Manual, which is the red book. So it's like a full-sized, like a letter-sized book. It's not so obvious what size these are when you see these photos, but
yeah, they're much bigger than you'd think.
What's kind of cool about these is actually when you look at the back, this thing, it says Apple Computer Inc. If you're used to the Apple II manuals, this looks like it's normally to scale, but when you hold one of these things in your hand, that print is huge. I mean, these things are surprisingly large. But the Apple II Reference Manual is basically, you know, sort of like the technical information that came with the original Apple II. The AppleSoft Reference Manual, the Blue Book, is actually quite a bit rarer.
Mm-hmm.
So these are both sort of like sought after collectors' items, and
yeah, especially the Blue Book.
Yeah, and these particular ones are in pretty good shape. They're not in great shape. They're not pristine, but they're in better shape than some. But the price, the buy it now price to get these, is $650. So. It's fairly impressive, but there are two reasons that I wanted to bring these up. One was that you don't see these very often, and you don't see them for, you know, in this good shape very often. And the other thing is, let's see if I can bring this over. I don't know if these are going to be visible. I have shirts that look like these. I didn't wear them. But
are the shirts much bigger than you think as well?
Actually, in fact, the reason I'm not wearing them is the exact opposite problem.
Okay.
So
they're actually just the size of the book.
They're a little bit too small. But I forget now who made them. I think it was Justin Scott made them, you know, in advance of one Kansas Fest.
Cool.
But I thought that was, those were very cool shirts. So someday when I'm thinner, I will wear them. Yeah. Okay. I think that's it for the auctions that I had. Carrington, you had observed that
we have another auction item from the discussion. First is Sorcerer Guy in the show notes was talking about your pick, Earl, the MITS 8800 parts kit. It says for the bare bones replicas. So there's actually one of those gave us an eBay item number.
Hmm.
So it's the bare bones CPU cards. They're for that, but they maybe can be used for an original as well. So I was like, well spotted. Look at that. Nice.
Cool.
Join the show. And speaking of joining the show, Tobias pointed out a really cool auction item. I'm like, and I think it was giving to us. I'm like, no, it's yours. So in the show notes now, Tobias is in our show notes as having a link, and your auction choice is there's two RCA Cosmac VIPs, one of which, the cheaper of the two, is in really, really nice shape. It's just a really nice find. The weird thing about the Cosmac VIP is it's RCA, all capitals, Cosmac, all capitals, VIP, all capitals. It's like the most shouty name of any computer from the 1970s. Yep. But this is a really, really nice one. Like, this is like super clean in box.
Mm-hmm.
So that's it. Just wanted to share that. I thought it was a really well-spotted thing. I might have picked it if I had noticed. In the show notes, he says, what was the note? That it was, the VIP was created by Joe Weisbecker, the creator of the ThinkDot and the Chip 8, both of which we have talked about before.
Very cool.
Yeah, I thought that was really well-spotted and a great suggestion. So I'm like, yep, welcome to the show.
Excellent.
That's awesome. Yeah. So just to clarify, Carrington, what you're saying is that kit of parts is for, like, not for an actual S100, but for something that is like a replica, a functional replica.
Yeah, but might work for the real one too, he says.
Oh, okay.
But there's the replica boards.
I see. Gotcha. Yeah, okay. That. Yeah, that's a great clarification. Thank you for that.
So listeners are very knowledgeable. And also has a great auction choice. I was like very, very impressed. Like, that's a great choice. Well spotted.
Does it have an S100 connector on it?
Seems to, yeah.
So, okay. It is actually an S100 board all put together like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's something.
Yeah.
You can do something with it.
Yep.
So anyway, that's
not
all
exactly
I had.
Sure what, but.
So we have reached the point of closing discussions. And Blake, you are first. What's up with you?
I don't have any big closing items. I'm still trying to get my head back into, it's not that big a leap since I'm not going to leave the house for several months, but being back from a little jaunt to the distanced beach. That's one of the things when you're, away, even though it's a pleasant, family trip, you do, not have access to the retro stuff. So, so it is nice to kind of fiddle around with a few things tonight in no particular planned fashion. Keeping on.
Excellent. And Carrington, what is this? You have a podcast.
Oh, I've been linked to another podcast called Smart Enough to Know Better. It's coming up on its 10th anniversary. I just ruined another podcast is basically what I'm saying. I've been feeling guilty about it all day. Mm-hmm. So they hit their 10th anniversary. It's billed as a podcast of comedy, science, and ignorance. Two amazing fellows that I'm actually friends with, Dan Beeston and Greg Waugh. They run it. It's a science podcast out of Australia. It's been just hit its 10 years, been doing 200 and something episodes. I think we're coming up on our 10-year anniversary soon for RCR. It'd be this year anyway.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so they normally interview experts about things. And so for their 10th anniversary celebration, they asked me to interview them instead. So because I'm pals with this guy. So I was on last night, we recorded and I interviewed them. And it was like the lowest energy thing I've ever done. I think I ruined their show. And I've been feeling guilty about it all day. But it's such a good podcast. And so anyway, people should listen to it, except maybe don't listen to the one that I just hosted. But they have 220 something episodes previous to that are all amazing. And then, then I came on board and ruined it. Been feeling bad all day, man. I was like low energy. I don't know. You can't knock them all out of the park. But I know low energy can't. And I don't know. I've got too much in my head about it. Too much pressure or something. I don't know. So, yep. Yeah, but it's an amazing show. Like, it's an amazing podcast. It's one of my, I've been listening since episode one. It's brilliant. What they do is they talk about like stuff in science. One of them is an actual science communicator. They both have backgrounds in comedy and improv though. So you can imagine like two improv guys. They were really into science, then interviewing scientists, like sometimes about obscure things or sometimes about like how you'd reboot the universe or like bizarre things or beer in space and just like cool stuff. But
this sounds like a podcast that'd be made for me. I've got to go listen to this.
Imagine it's hosted by like excited monkeys who just really want to learn, but they're just like, oh, like it's just, and they do comedy skits and they just like it. It's amazing. So it's called Smart Enough to Know Better. I love it. I've loved it for 10 years. It's one of those, you know, everyone likes podcasts. We'll have a couple of podcasts where when the episode of that comes out, you just like drop everything and listen. Mm. This is one of those for me. Like I just drop everything and listen when there's a new SE2KB. I just adore it. And then they asked me on last night to interview them. And I was like, oh God, what have I done? So this is the look of Carrington guilt. I've been feeling guilty all day.
Okay.
But I do recommend them. So hopefully I bring new listeners so I can make up for what I've done to them.
Yeah. No, it sounds interesting.
Yeah, highly recommend it. Like just honestly, just pick an episode and listen. It's amazing.
And I'm betting that you did probably three times a better job than you're thinking. Oh, I think
I've done a lot of podcasts. I know when I'm okay and I know when I've got like, oh God, yes, I know, really. But it is what it is.
Excellent. Earl, more podcasts that we should be listening to.
Instead of the RCR.
Yeah. Well, I hope so. I had two things to talk about, but I'm just going to talk about one because we're a little over time.
Oh, okay.
And I want to do the other justice. So I had a couple of really exciting donations to my collection. I'll talk about that next time. This time, I just want to mention that Randy Kindig of Floppy Days and Antic has teamed up with me to reboot a podcast that I started a few years ago, but then just kind of stumbled and didn't do any more with, but wanted to get it going again. It's called Next Without Four, which is an obscure reference to a basic error that you can get when you're programming. And the podcast is actually about programming. It's about programming retro computers, modern day. It's about how we programmed retro computers when they were retro back in the day. It's just about the combination of programming and retro. So in episode 2, which just came out a few days ago, Randy and I talk about our backgrounds in programming and computers. And in the upcoming episode that we're currently working on right now, we're going to hit the granddaddy of languages. We're going to talk about Fortran. So I'm just as excited as I could be to be doing this podcast with Randy, great co-host, very knowledgeable about the topic, and we're going to have a lot of fun with this. So nextwithout4.org is my shameless plug for the URL, and happy to be starting that one again because it's fun.
Worth plugging. I am a listener. I'm a subscriber. I liked your episode that you just put out, the one with Randy. Yeah. And I like how at the end you guys were talking about like the list of, you came up with that list of topics that you could kind of cover. And that got me very excited about future episodes. So,
yeah. Oh, cool.
Yeah,
cool.
Things are going to be a good one.
Yeah. The pause between episode 1 and 2 was very long, but.
Hopefully between 2 and 3 will be shorter.
Yeah, we're going to try and, you know, pull in the spacing on those, definitely. Maybe 3-4 years.
Yeah, no, it was very good. Listen to the, you know, episode 2 just recently as well with the punch cards and the Mark Sense cards and stuff. Is it me? I think it is me.
Yeah. What do you got, Paul?
We're on the plane, buddy.
I have. I think last time we recorded, I wasn't sure if I was going to submit a Kansas Fest presentation because the deadline was the day we recorded. I in fact, did.
Excellent. What are you doing?
I will be talking about Apple III things. So the my main session is the Apple III in 2020. And like the idea was essentially that I was going to play with all this sort of like new stuff, flash memory hard drives and a Wi-Fi modem and, you know, all these sort of like new things that you can use to use these machines in modern times. In fact, actually, yeah, I have a, what is it called? Flash Air. So it's like an SD card that has a little Wi-Fi station of its own. So I can like send things to the hard drive, you know, over the air. It's pretty cool. But anyway, so I've been playing around a lot with that. I brought home, my Apple III Plus and I have it all set up. It is my one retro machine here, but yeah. So I'm kind of looking forward to playing with that, you know, like, I would like to learn how to program something on it quickly. I have a couple weeks to try to write a thing.
No pressure, but
yeah.
That is so cool. I'm so fascinated by the Apple III. Got to touch one for a few months while we had it at the retail store. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so it's only so much you could learn, you know, in a tiny amount of time. It always fascinated me. And I love your podcast, the Drop 3 Inches podcast. I think it's great.
Yeah, I'm hoping
speaking of long time between episodes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I actually can't even remember when the last one was, but it was years ago.
They were still selling the Apple III at the time, actually.
Right. Yeah. One of the things I really kind of like about the machine is just that it was so underexplored. You know, like mm-hmm. there was no development materials while it was available, and you know, so everybody moved on by the time the development materials got out there. So anyway. It'll be fun to talk about, fun to play with until then. So. Mm-hmm.
Very much so. That's cool.
Oh, and I have a modern power supply in there so that it doesn't immediately like cause... Because, you know, getting back to the domestic tranquility topic, I mean, having this place smell like a burnt capacitor probably would not
that's
go
true.
Over well.
Releasing the magic smoke is not a way to stay married.
Love the smell of Rifa capacitors in the morning.
Exactly. No Rifa sure. madness is that... a thing, but anyway, okay. I guess that's probably good enough. Nobody's gonna react to my stupid pun, but okay, that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at bcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. And please write a review in iTunes. That will help people find the show. And so, until next time...
Retro Compute!